STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
I always wonder what newcomers are thinking when they hear that rooster. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and since last week we explained the rooster to a caller, I'm not going to do it now, but I'm glad that you're with me, and that rooster always signals the beginning of 3 hours of interaction between you and I about the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. As I dedicate myself to giving you a piece of my mind and expect that you'll do the same as we interact about these most important issues, for myself, from a perspective of classical Christianity, classical Christian values. And this first hour, I will not be taking calls. You're welcome to call in if you want to and sit on the line, and we'll get to you our second hour. But I'm dedicating the whole time just to a semi-private conversation. I mean private in the sense that I don't invite you to participate actively, but I want you to listen over my shoulder as I have a conversation with a friend of mine that I would like to introduce to you, somebody I've known for 8 or 9 years. He has a powerful story to tell, and he tells it in a powerful way in his recently released spiritual autobiography, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. So this is a story about a Muslim who becomes a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. His name is Nabil Qureshi, and Nabil, I should have had you on the show much sooner than this, given the fact that we've known each other for, 8 or 9 years, but I'm glad that we have this time to promote your new book. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a privilege to be here. Thanks so much, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. Gee, so much has been happening for you in the last 6 months or so. I know you're reasonably new on with RZIM, Rabbi Zacharias International Ministries. You have your new book out. You're considering a new program of education. You have an MD. You've got an MA in apologetics from Biola. You're an MA in some kind of biblical or New Testament studies from Duke. I'm looking for all the skinny on you here, and you're considering a PhD now over at Oxford. Your life is in a whirlwind, isn't it?
It's been a blessed time. I get to look into the questions that matter most to me in the graduate studies arena, and then I get to share that information with others. So I'm truly a blessed man.
Yeah, good for you. I think we first met in 2005 at Valley Forge. Was that right?
We did. A grand total of 3 months after I became a Christian.
Is that right? Well, you were a little bit wet behind the ears, I could tell, but it was great to talk with you because here's how I recall it, and you can correct me if I got it wrong, but what I recall is as we just had this little chat in the lobby of the EPS conference there. You said that you were a former Muslim apologist of sorts that ended up being convinced about Christianity. And I asked, well, how did that happen? And you said the Christian apologist had better apologetics or something to that effect.
Yeah.
Did that capture it as a little thumbnail sketch?
Well, really, that was the foundation of my conversion, was just how strong the arguments for Christianity are. Of course, from our specific conversation, all I can remember is you wearing a trench coat and saying, "One more ting."
I was doing the Columbo tactic. That's right. That's right. Well, the book is called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, and you sent me an email maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago describing three particular things that you wanted to accomplish with your book. Why don't you tell us what those three things are to kind of launch our conversation?
Yeah, the first third of the book, I hope to bring people into my life as a young Muslim, looking over my shoulder to understand Islam from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of books written about Islam, kind of telling people, informing them what Islam's about, but not showing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the hope for the first third. The
mm-hmm.
second third of the book covers the arguments that were introduced to me that showed me the case for Christianity was strong, and juxtaposing that with the case for Islam that showed me the argument for Islam was far weaker than
mm-hmm.
I ever realized while I was a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And the last third of the book is the dreams and visions that opened the door for me to accept Christianity, combined with the cost of becoming a Christian out of Islam, and what Muslims have to think about and what they have to pay in order to make that step.
Mm-hmm. My wife got your book first when we were at ETS in November, and we saw you there. She got a copy from Zondervan, and she wouldn't let it go until she was done. I mean, she devoured that book. And then we saw each other in December in Dallas and was able to have kind of a smaller community talk there, and I got to meet David Wood. We'll be talking about him in a little bit. But one of the things that I've enjoyed about your book is that this first thing you mentioned about giving an inside look into Islam, it is very difficult, in a sense, as I think for anybody who reads your story, to negatively objectify devout Muslims, at least, because this was your experience. You were raised in a devoutly Muslim home, and I want you to talk about that a little bit. But it's hard for us to objectify it. That is, just put them out there as they're the enemy or the bad guy, and look from without, because you bring us in so intimately to your home, we can actually see and feel the passion, the commitment, and the thoroughgoing commitment that your mother had, especially in raising you to be faithful to the God that she understood to be the true God. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and bring us into the story in that sense?
Yeah, Muslims, though often caricatured by various discussions, they're truly trying to please God. They're trying to please the God that they know of. When they pray these five daily prayers, when they follow the Sharia, when they do their best to emulate Muhammad in their daily lives, what they're doing is they're trying to please God and win his favor, very much like the Jews were trying to follow the 613 mitzvot up until Jesus' time and even to this day. So in order to show that, I basically shared how I fell in love with Islam as a young child, and by the time I was challenging Christians in their faith in my college years, I would truly say I was in love with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I love the faith. Mm-hmm. So growing up as a young Muslim, being taught Nabil, these are the prayers you're supposed to pray when you wake up. You thank Allah for giving you life every morning. As you go to the prayer rugs to pray the first of your five daily prayers, make sure you're ceremonially clean. This is how you do that. These are the prayers you recite as you're washing yourself ceremonially. The month of Ramadan, always a magical month for us, wake up early and to recite the Tahajjud prayers and Taraweeh prayers as well. Sometimes, standing 2 or 3 hours per day in the prayers, reciting sections of the Quran and hearing the Imam recite long sections of the Quran. Waiting for the sun to rise to start your fast, waiting for the sun to set to break it, and to join in fellowship with your community. I mean, really magical.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish the thought, and I'll jump
in. I was just going to say, to finish my thought, the pull of Islam is often a social pull. It's an intrigue. It's something that draws you in because the community around you, so loving and so kind and hospitable, all follows it. And the religion is based on the communal practice. And so a lot of draw to Islam that many people simply and unfortunately overlook.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wrote the word thoroughgoing down as you were talking, because it strikes me that in your experience, and I'm not sure you could speak to this too, Nabil, universal this is among Muslims. I know you've got very serious Muslims. You have also secular Muslims, and maybe you could talk about that in a minute. But I just wrote the word thoroughgoing because, in your experience, Islam was genuinely and truly a thoroughgoing way of life. And I began to think, as you were talking, a little bit about how Christians are with regards to their Christianity. And, of course, the people you and I know that we traffic with have thoroughgoingly Christian lives. But the rank and file, this may be a different case. And how, in your case, when you were talking about standing for these prayers for these 3 hours, you're talking about also when you were a kid. And so the training that you received was a training of a way of life, not just of a tangential belief system that attached to your life. Can you speak to that a little bit, especially with regards to the way Christians sometimes approach this?
Yeah, that's very true. You know, that's one thing that gave us a lot of pride when we were Muslims. We took a look at Christians and we'd say, okay, you live your Christian faith on Sunday mornings. Mm-hmm. We Muslims pray five times a day, every day. Mm-hmm. Thoroughgoing, I think, is a good word to use. It's a lens through which Muslims see the world. Everything Muslims do, if they're following Islam devoutly, is colored through the lens of Muhammad, mm-hmm. through what he said, through what he taught, through what he, as a conduit, revealed. Everything. Mm-hmm. Islam, you know, you have the 613 laws in Judaism. In Islam, there's far more than that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it can be enumerated. There's so many. Mm-hmm. Throughout your day, you know, you see Muslims who are, Muslim men will never wear gold. Devout Muslim men won't. Mm-hmm. You'll see Muslim men growing beards and shaving their mustaches. You'll see them sometimes with slightly higher hems on their pants. They don't want their pants to drag below their ankles. All this they do because Muhammad supposedly did it, mm-hmm. and they're trying to emulate Muhammad, mm-hmm. even to that degree. I mean, when they used to walk into a restroom as a young devout Muslim, I'd make sure to walk in with my left foot first because that's what Muhammad said to do. To that degree of practice, when you are a devout Christian, oftentimes you see the world that way. Yeah. Everything is about seeking God, the glory of God, looking
that's
for opportunities to love people.
The lens.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. That's how it's supposed to be lived. But since it's not rule-based, as Islam is, as mm-hmm. Judaism is, it takes a bit of maturity to get there, whereas mm-hmm. Islam, being so heavily rule-based, people are worried about what will happen if they don't follow the rules. That gets them doing it much more frequently.
Mm-hmm. Now, does it cause you distress, though, Nabil, when it seems that Christians are just more cavalier about their own, they're living their convictions consistently?
Oh, yeah. It's very distressing. In fact, a lot of the way modern Christianity is practiced is very distressing. For one, the cheap grace. I mean, the idea that Jesus died on the cross. Yay, let's move on. It's like, come on.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
God dying on the cross mm-hmm. for your sins? What? Mm-hmm. That should just cause us all to stop in our tracks. Right. But also this idea of it is for freedom's sake that Christ has set us free. People don't get that. Mm-hmm. You know, the veil has been torn. We can approach God, and we're free.
Which are
so
unique
many
concepts.
People around the world just bound by the rules
right.
In which they live their lives.
Yeah, I was going to say that is in such contrast to what you came out of. Even though there is this passion, this love for Islam, the backdrop is so completely different.
Exactly.
Yeah. I thought of the phrase familiarity breeds contempt, and sometimes our theological familiarity that we have with regards to God and the theological concepts causes us to sometimes take these things lightly. You and I both became Christians as adults, and so there's a different backdrop that we have to compare our Christianity to than just we've always been in this kind of situation, and so it becomes a little bit blasé for us to talk about things like the cross. Now, for us, these things, and I think especially you in the earlier stages of your journey with Christ, it's still vividly in your mind the contrast between the grace of the cross and what you were raised in.
It's an amazing gift, the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great way to put it. Tell us, let's see, where do I want to go? your mother... Tell us, she plays such a central role in your story. Tell us a little bit about her and her impact, because we're going to revisit this towards the end, as you do in the end of your book, and talking about that great love relationship, that disciple relationship with your mom. Then this created a tremendous problem when you became a follower of Christ. Tell us a little bit about that early relationship.
Well, my mother is a very, very loving woman. Very self-sacrificial, tender, caring woman. She's the eldest of six. Her father was a Muslim missionary, so her father was often away on missions, mm-hmm. and she would tend to her younger siblings. And so, natural caretaker. She taught me the ways of Islam. She taught the Aqidah, is what it's called, to recite the Quran. She was so intentional about that. She taught me how to recite Arabic. Mm-hmm. Even though we didn't speak Arabic in the house, we spoke Urdu, the language of Pakistan.
Right.
She taught me to recite Arabic by the age of four, so that I had read the entire Quran in Arabic by the age of five.
Well, just for clarification's sake, you recited it but you didn't, you weren't able to read it, or you didn't understand what the Arabic meant, or you did
understand? Correct. Yeah, the Muslim view is that recitation of the Quran brings barakat, it brings blessing. And so the meaning, yeah, it's important. You can read the translation for that, but far more important is the recitation.
So you learned massive portions of the Quran. I don't know how much. I'm curious to find out how much. It just by rote memory to repeat the sounds, even though you didn't know what the sounds meant.
Correct. You know, it's the obligation, the duty of reciting the Quran, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that Islam was originally established as an oral tradition with an oral text. I think the Quran wasn't intended to be a written book when it was initially written. So that's a large part of it. Those chapters that I had memorized, the last chapters of the Quran are short chapters, and so they're easy to memorize. But by the time I was in my teen years, I'd say I had about a fifth of the Quran memorized.
Wow. And which is a little phenomenal in the sense, is more significant because you didn't understand what the words meant. You memorized the sounds, as it were. But you knew, did you must have had translations, although translations are not exactly... I don't know if I could use the word kosher here or not, but you know what I'm talking about. The Quran was meant to be read in the original Arabic and not as a translation, but you must have had access to a translation, is that right?
Right.
For the content.
Actually used to give me sheets of paper. On one side was the Arabic, on one side was the English.
Mm-hmm.
The translation, like you said, not considered kosher because the Arabic itself, the words themselves are revealed, not the meaning, but the words.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Muslims don't believe you can accurately translate the Quran. So any translation is actually called an interpretation of the Quran, not a translation. But I used to memorize the two side by side.
Okay. So you knew the content of that which you were memorizing, but indirectly, as it were.
Correct. I was rare. Most of my friends who had memorized portions of the Quran had not memorized translations.
I wonder if it's because you had to really know the content that gave you a greater affection for it, because it strikes me if you're just memorizing sounds and movements of your body that it's hard to fall in love with that.
I actually would tend to disagree with you on that. I think the vast majority of Muslims attribute so much power and reverence to the Arabic of the Quran.
Even though they don't understand the meaning of the words.
Interesting. There's such a high degree of reverence that is the greater honor.
Tell us about the cultural upbringing, because you're Pakistani ethnically, but you weren't raised in Pakistan, were you?
Yes, I was born in the States, and apart from a short stint in Scotland, my dad was in the U.S. Navy, so he was stationed there for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We were mostly in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. The Pakistani upbringing came from the fact that my mother would travel in Pakistani Muslim circles, and we learned to speak Urdu in the home first, not English. I didn't learn English till I went to school.
Uh-huh.
And so just a very devout adherence to both religion and culture, and that's why I have that background in me.
Yeah. Oh, so what did Christianity look like to you from the inside of Islam?
It looks ridiculous. Hmm. It looks like a series of contradictions that lead to an inviolable religion. Basically, you believe that there's one God, yet you believe the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are all God.
Mm-hmm.
And unless someone explains that to you, that sounds like both gibberish and blasphemy at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that all your sins are forgiven, to the Muslim, what that sounds like is a license to sin.
Mm-hmm.
All your sins are forgiven, okay, then what's going to stop Christians from sinning? And you'll hear that question asked a lot.
Hmm.
That Jesus claimed to be God. The Quran says Jesus didn't. And so Muslims will often challenge the Bible, in terms of its historical accuracy. And having studied apparent contradictions anyway, in the book of Chronicles and in between the Gospels, etc., they're able to pose questions that the average unprepared Christian isn't able to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And you combine these factors together, and Christianity seems ridiculous to the average devout Muslim.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like a huge obstacle to overcome. You know, I had one other question before I go to break here, Nabil, and maybe I'll get to it, then we'll take a late break and then come back and talk about some other things. But you were talking about your own devout upbringing, and this is obvious as we read through your story. In fact, you know, I read 70 pages or maybe even more and I'm still in your life as a Muslim, you know, experiencing Islam through your eyes, and it's a very positive picture that you cite. You don't talk about Christianity for quite a while, but so you have a background in a very noble experience of your Islam. By the way, what were you Sunni, Shia, in terms of your own convictions, or you were actually a different group entirely? Now,
yeah, our practices were almost entirely Sunni, but our sect of Islam was a small splinter sect called Ahmadiyyat.
That's right. That's right.
And so, a lot of Muslims consider Ahmadis non-Muslims. I don't think that's a sustainable position.
Mm-hmm.
But the practices were virtually indistinguishable from Sunni Islam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The question that I wanted to ask had to do with secularized Muslims or kind of nominal Muslims. Obviously, you were not secularized. You were not nominal. Would you say, when it comes to American Islam, that most of the Muslims are like you or most are secularized? Or how would you divide it up? How would you characterize it?
I would say, had you asked me 7 years ago, I would say no.
No.
Because the circles, no, they're not nominal, because the circles I traveled in were all very devout.
Mm-hmm.
But now, having stepped out and seen a broader picture of what Islam is like in the U.S., I would say yes, the majority of Muslims in the U.S. are nominal. In fact, there was a recent survey done on the matter, and I don't remember the exact number, don't quote me. It's on the Pew Forum, it's on their website, but approximately two-thirds of Muslims in the West are nominal.
Mm-hmm.
But the even nominal Islam is more more loyal
devout
to its roots than nominal Christianity is to its roots.
Yeah, very interesting. My guest, Nabil Qureshi, his book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, has been out, what, 3 weeks now, 4 weeks?
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm curious how it's doing, or maybe you don't have numbers yet. I would think it's doing fabulous, or it will be shortly, because it's such a well-written and fascinating spiritual journey. That's great.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's in the Lord's hands. We'll see. Amazon is giving good results, but we'll see what the final number
is. Sure. Okay, great. We'll be back just in just a moment with Nabil. We'll ask him some more questions about his journey, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Stay with us.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason with my guest, Nabil Qureshi. And his book is Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Do you think Muslims are going to take offense at the title? I was just wondering about that.
Some might. I think it really depends on their disposition before they get to the book. I made every effort I possibly could to be conciliatory.
I think you accomplished. There's no question that your attitude is very charitable with regards to your past religious associations, your family, and indeed it was quite a struggle for you to even reconsider your own beliefs. Obviously, I guess that's an understatement a little bit now when I think about it. But what... I'm thinking that your friendship with David Wood was probably the, if not the turning point in the biggest sense, I mean, this comes down the line, but when you met David, this is where things began to shift a little bit for you. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
I would say exactly. It was upon meeting a Christian who was able to represent and provide a basic defense for his faith that things began to change.
Mm-hmm. Now we're not going to tell David's story now, but I got a chance to meet David in December when we were all together, and that was some fabulous, fascinating evening, I got to tell you. But that's another story. Let's just say that David wasn't afraid of you.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Would that be fair? He'd had some experiences in the past that made him apt for or capable for the occasion. Tell us about that, because I think a lot of our listeners, about the meeting and the flowering of that relationship, because I think a lot of our listeners, when they think of engaging a Muslim with regards to Christianity, even with the confidence they may have regarding their own convictions, to engage a Muslim who is not just devout, but articulate and intelligent and trained in communicating their convictions, and these were all true of you, for to take somebody like that on in a certain fashion. I mean, I think a lot of our listeners would have liked to have been a fly on the wall to see how that whole thing got off the ground and initiated. Why don't you tell us the fly on the wall perspective there of how that relationship developed?
Well, we were on the public speaking and debate team together, and this was just a few weeks after I had started college. And he was my roommate for the evening. We had gone to a tournament in, I think it was New Hampshire or Pennsylvania or something. Mm-hmm. And he was my roommate for the evening. And I saw him reading his Bible. That, to me, was flabbergasting. I had never seen anyone read a Bible before.
Huh.
I kind of assumed that all the Christians knew it had been corrupted and you couldn't trust it.
Okay, so it was flabbergasting to you because you had such a low view of the Scripture, not because you didn't think Christians took it seriously or were devout enough to have to actually read it in public or something like, or maybe there was a combination there.
It was definitely a combination.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never seen anyone read it before. I figured the reason why was because no one believed it was reliable.
Uh-huh.
And to see him reading it, and I knew he was an intelligent guy. I mm-hmm. already knew that part.
Now, he wasn't Dr. David Wood at the time, though.
No, he just became Dr. David Wood. So he was just
just recently. Okay,
Dave.
He was just Dave. Okay.
I challenged him immediately, as I had been taught to challenge the Bible ever since I was a child. I said, mm-hmm. How can you trust this book? Don't you realize it's corrupt? It's not trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that David had been raised as an atheist, had accepted Christ in his young adult life when mm-hmm. he was, I think, 19 or so. He accepted Christ, and he had studied the Scriptures as far as why he should trust it.
Mm-hmm.
So he had answers to share with me.
So you
never had anyone had those answers before.
Yeah, so you kind of walked right into it without knowing it. You made the objection with somebody who actually had the goods and could respond. Do you recall, in a thumbnail sketch, the way he responded to you?
Well, first he began teasing out the fact that I didn't quite know what I was objecting to.
Mm-hmm.
He's
asking your questions for clarification's sake? Is that what you mean, or is he directly challenging?
Well, the first thing I said was the Bible has been corrupt, and his response was, go on.
Uh-huh.
So it was like,
good. Hey, that's in the Columbo spirit. That's fine. I like that.
So I started
explaining
what I
thought
was the
case. Tell me more. Yeah.
He started asking more questions. He says, well, you're saying the Bible's corrupt. Where is it corrupt? What are you talking about? What's mm-hmm. the evidence? And the more he was asking those kinds of questions, the more I realized no one had asked me that before.
Uh-huh.
And I had a general idea that, things have been added to the Bible because
uh-huh.
that's what I had heard.
Yeah.
But he said, well, what are you talking about? Well,
uh-huh.
I don't know. Just things have been added. And, translations. I knew that there had been multiple translations of the Bible, that Jesus spoke Aramaic, and that the Bible was written in Greek, and that mm-hmm. now we're reading it in English. So
mm-hmm.
Because the Quran was just in Arabic, I could say, oh, your book has been through all these translations. How do you mm-hmm. know it's reliable? Mm-hmm. And then he started telling me about the Greek New Testament manuscripts, and he started telling me about textual integrity, teasing that out from the issue of canonicity and inspiration. So he starts giving me these terms which help clarify my thinking,
mm-hmm.
and it shows me that he's thought about it before, mm-hmm. and he's further down the road, and he accepts the Bible. So all these thoughts are coming into place for the first time, and I'm realizing that there's a lot more here to deal with than I had originally thought.
You know what just occurred to me, though, about this conversation, and it's occurred to me before in with regards to other conversations I've had, and I know Christians have had with non-believers, is that when the folks who don't share our convictions have objections about our views, they've a lot of times garnered these objections from their own community, where they're given full encouragement with regards to them. And so they come into a conversation with their sails full of themselves, so to speak. And I don't know if this was your case or not, but just with a lot of confidence. And of course, like your statement was, of course, it's been corrupted. And I'd say probably the majority of the time, unfortunately, there is no reasonable response offered. But when David, unaffected by your bluster there, and not chased away or frightened by it, just began to not only draw you out and ask you questions that you weren't able to answer fully, but then offered information that you were unfamiliar with. It seems to me, as you described it, like a little of the wind went out of your sail there, and you hadn't expected that.
And it's true. I hadn't expected it. I'd never seen it before, and I had a new respect for David, mm-hmm. a Christian who had reasons. That was a shock to me.
Gosh. So this was just the beginning, though, now of a relationship. So now you respect him, and after this debate in which you were rooming together, then did you picked up a relationship, or this continued? That you're going to the same school, presumably. That's why you're on the same debate team. Is that right?
Right, we were in the same school. I was pre-med, he was biology, so we had a lot of the same classes that we actually then intentionally signed up for.
No kidding, because you became buddies then.
Yeah, we became real friends.
Huh.
You know, we started hanging out together, talking about these things more. He'd come over to my house and study chemistry with me. I'd go to his house, study genetics. I mean, it was a real friendship.
Yeah, and so was the religious component of your conversation a main part of your friendship? Not that you wouldn't have been friends apart from that. It sounds like you clicked on a personal basis. But was this kind of the picture I'm trying to get is, you know, how much of the religious conversation was an ongoing part of your relationship?
I would say we hung out, enjoyed life together about 90% of the time, and the other 10% was, in fact, directly engaging religious matters.
Uh-huh. Now, the reason this is important to me is I think that Christians need to see this, that evangelism isn't just an event where you're pounding away at somebody's head, and every time you get to see them, you're firing another salvo. But the way I like to think of it now, it's more being an ambassador. When you're engaged over time with people and you're putting stones in their shoes over time, and while in the case that you had with David, you know each other and you're able to enjoy each other's friendship in a genuine way.
Yeah, we lived life together. We were real friends and studying together and doing the public speaking and debate team. And, I mean, it was in the context of a life lived together, I was able to address these matters with someone I trusted.
Mm-hmm.
This would not have happened. At least I don't envision it happening unless David had been a real true friend.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that your conversations were not intense or maybe even heated, or how did that play out?
there were times when we'd slam the door on each other. I mean, David was still a young guy.
Yeah.
He was hot-blooded. and so we would say, I'm never talking about this ever again, and slam the door.
Uh-huh.
that happened a lot.
Uh-huh. Well, it's good to hear that.
The matter was, we were friends, and so a day or two later, I'd run into him again, and
we'd smooth
things over, and off we go again.
Off we go again. And see, because I try to also explain that people, you know, we write our stories in our books, and these things, we try to take these occasions, and we're as truthful to the details as we can be, but a lot of times it's messier than it looks on paper because we're trying to condense, you know, and move through it quickly. But the actual living it out is just a little bit untidy, and that's okay. Because that's just the way life is. These things don't often just go off without a hitch.
Yeah, and I mean, you think about families. You know, families are quite often dysfunctional on some level, but you stick together because you're family, and friends work the same way. You have arguments, you get angry, you might even fight, but you're still friends. Mm-hmm. So you end up coming back together.
Hopefully, and I hope even in casual conversations that aren't extended, that followers of Christ are thinking of modeling that kind of behavior, and hopefully then having a greater impact, even if it's a shorter interaction with a person. Tell me this, Nabia, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about the evidence for Christianity vis-a-vis Islam in the conversations that you had with David?
Vis-a-vis Islam, I would say that the evidence for Jesus' death on the cross is virtually undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
The Quran denies it. Chapter 4, verse 157 of the Quran says very clearly Jesus was not killed on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And Muslims believe Jesus didn't die, period.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that Jesus died on the cross, to me, that the evidence would be so strong that he died.
Mm-hmm. The historical evidence you're referring to, yeah. Because this then, I mean, if that one fact is a fact, and given the emphasis on the Quran as the perfect revelation from God that is the absolute authority, then one fact of the Quran that turns out not to be a fact begins to undermine the entire authority of the Quran. Is that the way it worked for you?
For the Quran, I would say that's a valid argument because unlike the Bible, which has multiple authors, the Quran has one author, and it has one genre. And so if you have one fact that's clearly wrong, then that does undermine the authority of the entire Quran.
Is this what happened to you, though? Were you confronted with this particular piece of information? You remember it quite well. You went right to it when I asked the question. Was this one of those things that was a certain kind of a theological turning point for you, or that shook the earth a bit for you?
It certainly shook the earth. Now, the first thing someone will do when a major component of their worldview is challenged is they will try to justify it, and they will try to find evidence to outweigh the cognitive dissonance that is caused by this evidence. And so for me, I said, okay, looks like Jesus died on the cross, but there's still much more reason, apart from this issue, to trust Islam than Christianity. So I applied more epistemic weight to other arguments.
Right. And, you know, I just want to I think that's actually a completely legitimate move to make. When you have a worldview that is like a net, that there may be some foundational issues there, but there's a lot of things that are working together, and you have in your own mind a cumulative case that you've made. When one thing seems to misfire, that doesn't by itself necessarily disqualify all the other things that you think are legitimate. And I find this in Christianity as well, where people will poke at something, and I'm not going to be able to maybe come up with a response that's going to be satisfying to them or even to me. But that doesn't mean that the whole edifice comes tumbling down because there's a lot more supporting it than just that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, 100%. So I think your response, you know, was legitimate. But there was more. When I qualified my question about the most surprising thing you learned about Christianity vis-a-vis Islam, you answered that question. Was there something else that, not so much with regards to Islam, but in general about Christianity that really surprised you, that stood out, that you didn't know?
Well, I would say just how important the resurrection was. I understood that Christians believe Jesus had risen from the dead. But it wasn't made clear to me how central this was, not just to the theology, because, of course, if Jesus is risen, that changes a lot, theologically speaking, but how central it is to the case for Christianity.
Right.
If Jesus is risen, I mean, that's big.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that Gary Habermas was visiting our university, and I got to hear him speak on this, and that really, really jarred me and shook my understanding of Christianity.
Now, when my wife, Steece, and I were going through the book, she actually pointed out as she's reading, says, here's a conversation that David and Nabil are having with some friends of David's, Mike and Gary. And she said, do you think that's Gary Habermas and maybe Mike Lacona? And I said, Mike and Gary sitting on the couch, you know, Mike Lacona and Gary Habermas, two of the world's best scholars in the area of resurrection, just happening to be yucking it up with Dave and Nabil on the couch? Probably not. But it turned out that was the case.
Yeah, it was. Dave didn't let me know what was coming. One day he said He said, "Hey, Nabil, you told me that your dad would like to have a conversation on these matters. How about we have it at the friend at one of my friend's house? His name's Mike, and one of Mike's good friends, Gary, is coming to town. So how about you and your dad have a conversation with Mike and Gary?"
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Sure." I didn't know these guys from Adam. And it turned out to be two scholars. I mean, Mike at the time wasn't a scholar yet, but he was
he's on his way, though.
Gary, who had been doing his dissertation since the mid-70s on the historical resurrection of Jesus.
That's right.
I bet you the Lord works in wonderful ways.
Right. I bet you there's no one else in the world that probably knows more about the resurrection of Jesus in terms of scholarship and the case for it and everything than Gary Habermas. And there he was sitting on the couch with you guys talking.
The man has read every single dissertation and article written on the historical Jesus death and resurrection since 1975 in French, English, and German. I don't think you can know more than that.
Gary, get a life, man. Well, that's fabulous news. Look, I got to go to break, and then we'll come back. I want to talk about the real change, the supernatural element, when you decided, gee, I've been mistaken, and this guy, David Wood, and those like Gary and Mike are right about this, and then what this cost you. Talking with Nabil Qureshi, his book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Zondervan, the publisher, it's a fabulous book, friends. If you want to get a single book to introduce you to the whole element of understanding Islam from a devout Muslim's point of view and how transformation is possible and how God did it in a particular life, and understanding particulars and details about Islam. This is the book. You know, you have call-outs all through this with every time you make a reference to a Muslim concept or text or something, holy day, whatever, you have a little description of it so we don't get lost in the terminology. It's a great tool in that regard. Let's go to break. Come back in a few moments on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. We've got about 15 minutes to go with my guest, Nabil Qureshi. His book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, Zondervan. It's kind of a must-read if you want to get a background in Islam. I've actually shied away from books on Islam, Nabil, just because they just always seem so tedious to me, all this new theology, all of this stuff. But your treatment, it's brilliant the way you have woven an instruction, a tutorial, if you will, on Islam into your spiritual autobiography here to help us to not only get an understanding, but to have a charitable kind of understanding of Islam through the way you've characterized it. I think you've done a great job there.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, the hope was, in order to really be able to respond to something, you have to truly understand it first.
Yeah.
When you're sharing the gospel with Muslims, I mean, it's you're sharing beliefs, sharing doctrine, but when you realize how much that impacts their life, all of a sudden you have a new appreciation for how important prayer is, mm-hmm. how important community is in your sharing of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the transition, the crux, the turning point for you, where you began to think really deeply that this whole thing might be true, this whole thing about Jesus and the Bible and Christianity might actually be true, and I might have been following a mistake or a false understanding of God and Jesus up until now. Tell us about that point in your life.
It was when David challenged me. He said, Nabil, we've been studying the Bible, Jesus' death, his resurrection, his deity for so many years, and you've been using very sharp, critical criteria in order to investigate it. When will you apply the same razor to Islam and be consistent?
Mm.
And I responded kind of blasé. I was like, well, I know Islam is strong enough to respond to the challenge. And he said, well, do it then. And so I applied the same critical criteria to Islam, and I realized the sources were later, they were less reliable. The Quran had even less reason to believe in its inspiration. I thought it had a ton, but as I started looking carefully, it didn't. And so when the case for Islam started crumbling, I realized that made it much more necessary for me to take Christianity seriously in my life.
But would you say that your response then was that you got softened, or did you dig your heels in a little bit?
Oh, I dug my heels in. I dug my heels in for a while until I came to a point where I even tried to deny reason. I tried to deny our ability to reason because reason was pointing to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to deny it every which way I could. I tried to deny the evidence until finally I realized I was going to be accountable before God.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just keep going on denying. I have to choose God or my life.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that David had presented to me early on in our walk. He said, if Christianity were true, would you be willing to follow it? And I had said, yes, were it true. I said, of course it's not, but were it true,
yeah.
I'd be willing to follow it. And so later, when it came to that point, I had my prior promise to lean on.
Mm. I have a citation here, I think, from your book. It's in a piece that was sent out about seeking Allah, finding Jesus. And you write, I had lived my whole life with vibrant confidence. Islam, my beliefs, my family, my words and actions all converged into one point, me. I had been authentic and transparent, able to speak my mind and live my beliefs freely and fully. But now I was a shell, outwardly clinging to Islam while inwardly a torrent of confusion. Sounds like this was written about this period of your life we're talking about right now.
Exactly. That was as I was transitioning into medical school, and I realized that there was no foundation for Islam anymore. That was a very, very difficult time for me.
Now, was it difficult? It's rhetorical, but I want you to answer. The answer to me is obvious. Was it difficult because of the cost that would be you'd have to pay in light of your family's response, your cultural upbringing, all of that? I mean, it was more than just an intellectual changing your mind. There was a lot on the line here.
Yeah, and that stuff, it's all calculated subconsciously. You know, what is it going to cost for me to accept this message? Well, I'm going to have to leave my family, leave my friends. It's going to bring immense pain. I'm going to have to change the way I see the world. It might even change my career goals.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff is subconsciously processed, and it comes out in cognitive dissonance,
mm-hmm.
To where you know something's true, but you're denying it. You're not entirely sure why.
So there's this inner conflict. I had a chuckle inside when you say change your career goals, because now you're a speaker for RZIM, you know. Goodness gracious, what a change. So from where you'd been, now a defender of Christianity. So now when I met you, I asked you a question, as I recall, that was is a question that I ask every time now I meet a Christian who had been a Muslim, because of the frequency of some kind of supernatural element in the conversion. And I said, was there some kind of element like that in your life? Now, we both have a friend in Abdu Murray, and who is also a former Muslim attorney out of Detroit, I think maybe now with RZAM as well. But he did not have any supernatural things, but it turns out many, if not most, seem to. And when I asked you about that, you said, yes, there was that element too. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Recent surveys have indicated that anywhere between 50 and 70% of former Muslims who are now followers of Christ had a supernatural event.
Hmm.
I just got an email from someone this morning who was telling me he would listen to my debates, but he never accepted Christ until Christ appeared to him in a dream.
Hmm.
50 to 70% is the number showing up on surveys. I tend to lean towards the latter number because I just see it in pretty much everyone I talk to.
Yeah, right. Well, you had dug your heels in a little bit, and it seems to me you might have mentioned that to me when we first met. And he had better apologetics, but the apologetics weren't enough to push you over because so much was at stake, and this supernatural element really was had a decisive role.
Well, what happened was I told David, I said, I've been seeing the world through an Islamic lens my whole life. How could God expect me to grasp a finite truth like the deity of Christ in order to have eternal salvation? I said that's unfair because I don't have access to objective truth given my subjective perception.
Mm.
And to me, I thought that was a very sophisticated response.
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, okay, there's an equivocation there between objective and subject. Of course, you know that now. But anyway, so that was your complaint. Some people didn't follow that, but I got you so far. Okay, go ahead.
And David said, Nabil, you believe in God. You believe God has spoken to your family before in dreams and visions. Why don't you ask him?
Mm-hmm.
And that just took the wind out of the sails of my objection.
Wow.
Because I did believe in God.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I knew he had given my family prophetic dreams and visions before.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, it was a matter of seeking him. And at that point, I really began to seek Allah. And that's where the title of the book comes from, actually.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So when did you become a Christian? When would you say that transition took place? Was it a decision you made some night, a prayer you prayed, or a realization you came to that set you on a new path of following Jesus? How did that play out?
I prayed the prayer at 3 o'clock in the morning on August 24th, 2005.
Huh.
And
were you by yourself?
I was by myself.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even know I was supposed to pray a prayer.
Right.
David hadn't given me those instructions, he was shocked when he found out. But it was at a point where I was reading through the Bible. It was my lifeline at that point because I turned to the Quran for some personal guidance and I couldn't find it there. And I turned to the Bible and it was just reverberating off the page.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started reading the Bible. I just started absorbing. I wasn't even a Christian yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was speaking to me so loudly. And then I got to Matthew chapter 10. Which said, if you confess me before the people of this world, I will confess you before my Father in heaven. But if you deny me before the people of this world, I will deny you before my Father in heaven.
When
I got to that verse, I realized I needed to confess Christ. Mm. And that's when I got on my knees and confessed Christ.
Wow.
That's the moment I say I became a Christian.
Wow. I have spent a lot of time in that chapter the last few months, and partly because it talks about the conflict that will come to those who follow Christ. And there are three times in that chapter where Jesus says, do not fear them. Do not fear them, do not fear them, do not fear them. There are different ways he says it, but the phrase is there in each case. And part of it is pitting families against themselves in virtue of their faithfulness to Christ. And this, how did that play out? We just have a couple more minutes, but say something about what has become of the relationships with your family in virtue of your conversion to Christianity.
After I became a believer, it was extremely difficult for my family. I mean, I was the guy who loved Islam. I was the guy who my parents had pride in. I'm the eldest son, the only son in our family, a very patriarchal culture, and that I became a Christian not just was a decision affecting me and my life, it brought tremendous shame to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so by me becoming a Christian, I'm decimating their reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was extremely difficult for them and for me. And for the better part of a year, we didn't talk. It was their decision to not talk to me.
Mm. You didn't have any interaction? Is that what you mean? Or you didn't talk about spiritual things?
We didn't have any interaction at all.
Huh. So they just kind of closed the door on you and you were left out of the family.
That's about right.
Wow,
for the better part of a year.
Yeah, that must have been really hard.
And so it was very difficult. And we're at a place now. It's been almost 8 years, almost 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're at a point now where we're talking and we're trying to recapture some of that lost time, especially now that my father realizes this is a real change. It's going to be with me for the rest of my life. My mom's still grappling with that. But it's been very, very difficult. They didn't come to my wedding. They haven't approved of me ever since. But I'm praying that the Lord will work in their lives and reconciliation will happen in Jesus' name.
Well, Nabil, you're an encouragement to me, and I've valued the friendship we've had over the last 8 years. We don't get to see each other that much. Every couple times a year, we bump into each other and share some tales and enjoy each other's company. So I look forward to seeing you next time. I want to thank you for being on the show and for writing this wonderful book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm honored to be your friend.
Thank you. All right. Nabil Qureshi has been my guest. Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus is the book. A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity, and I just highly recommend it. It's do we have that at Stand to Reason now? We don't feature that just now. Well, you can get it on Amazon. Doesn't matter to me at this point. What I'd like you to do is get the book and benefit from what Nabil has to say. And one of the things that I was taken with is Nabil's his devotion as a Muslim, for goodness sake, and to see that level of devotion, even though his theological convictions were mistaken, is almost humbling. And now to see him adopting, putting that same energy towards his love for Christ and for the kingdom is really, really encouraging. And if you get a chance to ever hear Nabil speak, he's with RZIM, and so he's traveling around the country, around the world, actually, debating and defending Christianity and giving account for the hope that's within him. Go and see. He's probably got some things on YouTube. I don't know, but I highly encourage you to check that out, and then go ahead and read the book, and learn here a little bit about Islam and some of the things that really made a difference to Nabil, because those are the same kind of things that could make a difference to a Muslim friend that you find in your own life. And my understanding, and I don't interact a lot with Muslims, I don't have much occasion to, but that's probably going to change in the future because there are more and more in our communities. And Alan Schliemann, though, has told me, and he does a lot of that, he says that Muslims love talking about religion. And it's easy to sit down with them and have a conversation. They might be a little aggressive with their point of view. Fine, let them talk. Just like David Wood said to Nabil when Nabil offered the challenge, he said, continue, tell me, lay it out for me, let me hear it. And in kind of Columbo fashion, got all the details and then began to respond because he had some things to offer. And over time and in friendship made a huge difference in Nabil's life. All right, that's it for our hour here, friends. Two more hours coming up along with your calls. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Almost didn't make it. Hey, we're thrilled to have been awarded a spot among the top five Christian apologetics apps for Android. This, according to, the Christianity Examiner, Jarrettsville Christianity Examiner. I don't know who they are, but I'm glad they included us here. Our friend Doug Powell with iJesus or iGospels or iResurrection, one of his iBooks that are these fabulous interactive guides. He was one of the recipients, Southern Evangelical Seminary, Reasons to Believe, and Reasonable Faith. So all people that we know and are friends with were at the top there, but we were glad to be grouped with them and also grouped as one of the best apps. This is the Android app, but we have an app obviously for Mac and Android. Some of you haven't thought of that. Let me just tell you what they said because it just sounds so great. I love reading it. It makes my heart feel good, and that is Stand to Reason is the thriving apologetics ministry headed by me, and they mentioned something about that. And it says it's known for non-combative, frank, honest, and friendly discussion on the truth of the Christian faith. SDR's app includes a variety of daily updating podcasts, blogs, and articles, both philosophical and evidential in nature. These aren't just limited to Kokel's work, but includes, and I like this part, the best from all members of the SDR staff, and we have a very deep bench, each with their own area of focus and expertise. So, wow, thank you. Proud of that, and proud and happy to let you guys know about that, because now you can get the app if you don't have it. It's an easy way to access our material while you're on the go. Now, I have I mentioned Doug Powell and his iResurrection. This is a book that is hard to describe. There is an app that has to do with his offerings. He's done a couple of different books. And they're kind of coffee table size. And if you open the book, let's just talk about iResurrection. That would be lowercase I and then capital R Resurrection, lowercase I Resurrection, like iPhone iResurrection. And what it is it's an interactive book that chronicles the details regarding the life of Christ in the last few days that pertain to the resurrection. And they have all these little, it's like a scrapbook look to it, and it'll fold up things with pieces of information and interactive things to do as you're flipping the pages. Now, his app is much like that, I understand. I don't use the app, but I have the books. And I mention this because my daughter Annabeth, 9 years old, was going through iResurrection the other day, all on her own. I bought the books for my girls because not only is it fun for adults, but it's fun for kids. And the younger kids just have fun going through it because it looks like fun. but my 9-year-old is interested in the content also. And because she's just coming into the logic stage of her development as a thinker, as a young person, grammar, logic, rhetoric is the trivium. Say middle school, she's in fourth grade, just on the front edge of that. She's interested in the arguments. And there they have these things laid out in a very accessible form. So we talked about the missing body. And she was reading this, and she was saying, gee, look, at these are kind of silly reasons that people reject the resurrection of Christ or try to explain it away. I said, yeah, they are. And we sat down and started to look through them. And so then I began to quiz her. I said, well, look at the body's missing, right? We know that. Yeah, well, who could have stolen the body? Because this was the claim by some that the body's been stolen. Jesus didn't rise from the dead. A stolen body explains the empty tomb. Okay, who would steal the body, Annabeth? Well, the Romans, the Jews, or the disciples? Yeah, those are the only three groups. Now, would the Romans want to steal the body? No, they wanted Jesus dead. Would the Jews want to steal the body? No, they wanted Jesus dead. Would the disciples want to steal the body? No. Well, why not? Well, here we had a little discussion to get more of the details because the claim was that the disciples stole the body. So It turns out that isn't a good option either, but we were able to talk about some of these things, and I was using the work that Doug Powell did in iResurrection as a visual guide to help me to do that. So here I had, and this is kind of the takeaway, here I had a tool for training that I could use with my logic stage daughter to help her to understand how the particulars go together. She already knows that Jesus rose from the dead. She learned that in the grammar stage. Now, what are the reasons why people think he didn't? And so there's a coherence here of putting it all together, and then what's wrong with those reasons? And so I was able to use that wonderful interactive book to talk about some of these details and to disciple my daughter a little bit in the defense for the resurrection. It was great. It was fun. It was easy. And we've revisited that since then, and I'll have a chance to go back again. We're getting closer to Easter. It'll be fun to go over those even with my six-year-old, and she'll just enjoy turning the pages and look at some of the details and the pictures and knowing it's about Jesus. A lot of it won't register. She'll miss it, but next time around when she's a little bit older, it will mean more. I'm just saying this to recommend iResurrection and its companion. What is the companion? Is it iGospel or, Melinda, the iBook that's a companion to iResurrection, the other one that he did? We featured them both here at Stand to Reason. iJesus. Okay, there you go, iJesus. And that's the broader life of Christ. And no kidding, three more coming out on May 1st. Okay, we'll have Doug on the program in May to talk about these things. Again, it's always a little bit difficult to talk because it's not so much the content on these as it is the presentation, but we'll talk about that. And you can get these at str.org. I'm sure at our bookstore, in the May ones, when they come out, they'll be available too. But I just want to recommend both of these to you as a training tool for your children, all right? People are asking us all the time, gee, what can I use with my kids? Here's a way to do it. In the first stage, in the grammar stage, you just want to get kids familiar with the concepts. When I say grammar stage, I'm talking about that stage of development from, say, 5 to 9, or maybe 10, depending on your kid, where they're learning particulars, but they don't really know how it all goes together. Well, you're not going to teach apologetics to six-year-olds, because they cannot conceptualize those. You can communicate the facts about God's nature and the person of Christ and the resurrection, the details of the life of Jesus, but how this all goes together in more an argument form, and you make a case for it, this comes at a later stage, more the middle school stage. But the iResurrection and iJesus can be used for either one. And I don't know what the other I's are that are coming up in May, but I'm looking forward to that. So let that just be a recommendation to you. Doug Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. I've known Doug for a long time, and so happy to see him take his significant skills as a graphic designer and artist and an apologist and put this all together in not only these interactive books, but the interactive app that also was on the best five in the article that I mentioned earlier. So please check that out. Now, I have a question coming up here, the first question of the day, that has to do with something I wanted to address here by way of commentary. So I think what I'll do is I'm going to bring Todd in Mansfield, Texas, on board. And Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome, Greg. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm very glad to, and I'm glad you brought the topic up. I knew nothing about this topic that you're going to raise until earlier today, and then Amy brought me up to speed, and she printed out some things from the internet. I read statements and got very angry. So why don't you go ahead with your question and tell me what you're about, and then we'll pursue this topic a little bit more.
Sure. Well, I guess first I just wanted to agree with you on the Doug Powell stuff. My kids are about the same age as your girls, mm-hmm. and I've used the eyewitness resurrection with my son, and he's really gotten a lot out of it, and we've enjoyed doing that together. So, great stuff. And anyway, I guess to frame my question broadly, I think of it more as a stewardship question. And in a nutshell, I was looking through the news, I guess, yesterday, and I saw a story about World Vision and how they have expanded their hiring practices.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes now people who are in a same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess where the stewardship comes in is, you know, we have options as Christians, you know, in how we spend our money. And, you know, if you read some of the stuff that I guess Michael Brown puts out and some others, it's just about impossible to live in the world and not spend money, you know, with anyone who has any relationship with the LGBT agenda.
Yeah, wherever you spend money, it's going. Yeah, I understand that.
Exactly.
That's true.
But I guess where this kind of really piqued my interest was the difference between this and something like Target or some other company is that this is not just a company that happens to be run by people who profess to be Christians, but they bill themselves as a Christian organization.
Well, they are a Christian organization. World Vision is one of the 10 largest charities in the country with a goal to take the great the commission of Jesus to help the poor to the world, and they're famous for this, and they do a lot more than that too. So I've worked with World Vision people overseas. When I lived in Thailand, there was a team of World Vision people that were there, and they were wonderful. And I've always had a high regard for World Vision, not just as a humanitarian agency, but as a Christian organization. That is, they are going out and still are. I mean, there's nothing in this regard has changed as as Christians, based on the command of Christ, to make a difference for the cause of Christ. This is they're a thoroughgoing Christian organization. So I think you're right about that. That makes this organization different.
Right, and my wife and I have, you know, we have sponsored children through World Vision for 12 or 13 years,
mm-hmm.
and so I guess I just wanted to hear your thoughts
mm-hmm.
about. Because I don't feel like, you know, my first reaction, honestly, is kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and not just to this, but to a lot of situations, and I've learned to kind of take a step back and
good
think about things, you know,
yeah.
before I take action.
Mm-hmm.
But my first response is to think, well, you know what, I've got other places that I can spend my money. There are
right.
lots of other ministries that are out there and some that, you know, we're personally involved with, and maybe we should shunt the money there, but I just wanted to hear what your thoughts were on,
sure, yeah.
on that, and I'll just kind of be quiet and let you talk.
All right, good. And if you want to, you know, chip in your 2 cents, just jump right in. I do have a lot to say about this. Here is the Christianity Today article headline, and let me just check the date, March 25th. This is today. World Vision, why we're hiring gay Christians in same-sex marriages. Now, I think that title captures, or that headline, if you will, captures the content of the article quite well. And I'll be reading some things out of here. But I mean, talking to you, Todd, when I saw that that headline, World Vision, why we're hiring gay Christians in same-sex marriages, it struck me that there are two oxymorons there. That is contradictory terms, gay Christians and same-sex marriage. Gay Christians, is that a contradiction? Well, in the way they're using it, yes. I think it's possible for a Christian to have same-sex attraction and even be faltering in how well they're managing that and still be Christians, because we all have sinful impulses, and we all falter in some measure in how we're handling it. However, this is not a Christian with same-sex impulses who's thinking that maybe this isn't consistent with being a Christian and I need to be working out in discipleship how to manage these wrong impulses. This is a Christian, a so-called Christian, who has entered into a same-sex marriage. And that means they have embraced homosexuality as an appropriate Christian lifestyle. And my response to that is an oxymoron. It's hard to me to imagine how it's possible for a person who is a genuine Christian in the New Testament sense to embrace something that God calls an abomination and celebrate it as if it were a gift from God. To me, that's similar to somebody saying, yes, I am an adulterer Christian. Hallelujah. Adultery is beautiful. And I live in adultery as much as possible. However, I am committed adulterous relationship with another woman. So I'm not sleeping around. It's just this one married woman that I'm sleeping with. But isn't it great? Praise the Lord. Who would extend the right hand of fellowship to somebody who says that kind of thing? You know? And I think the same thing is true here with gay Christians, at least in the context that it's spoken of here. So what World Vision is doing is acknowledging that there are Christian people with same-sex attraction that are celebrating their same-sex attraction through getting a legal marriage in the states where it's possible. And they're in Washington State, so that's possible. And they do not see this in any way, shape, or form as a compromise of Christian conviction. And the reason they say that, and I know they don't see that in any way, shape, or form, because they say here in another missive that the board and I wanted, now this I is, where's the, it, I think this I is the, is President Richard Stearns, the board and I wanted to prevent, that's not what I wanted to read. World Vision requires that everyone we hire, without exception, must affirm that they are a sincere follower of Christ. That is our non-negotiable condition of employment. Quote, unquote. I'm just reading it from World Vision. This is from their website. Now, regarding this change in practice, how the conduct policy that they've changed, employee conduct policy. So they are hiring what they call gay Christians that are in same-sex marriages, thinking that such people, that such behavior is consistent with the idea of being a sincere follower of Christ because that's a non-negotiable. So they think that homosexual behavior is consistent with being a sincere follower of Christ. There's no way to avoid the logic of that.
Right.
So that's the first thing, just from the title. And there's nothing in the entire article that gainsays that conclusion I've just offered. And then they say that they use the term same-sex marriage. And, of course, at this particular point, in my view, they have been completely taken in by the secular understanding that marriage is something that is constructed by cultures and can be redefined at will. And our culture now, in some states at least, have redefined it to include same-sex unions. And as far as Richard Stearns and the rest of the World Vision crowd are concerned, that's good enough for them. If the state says that marriage, that same-sex marriage is a marriage, well, then they're going to call it a marriage too and welcome those kinds of unions. Now, what's curious about this, when you read the articles pertaining to this, the interview in CT, Christianity Today, with Richard Stearns and their own statements to this effect, they state, this is not an endorsement of same-sex marriage. I'm quoting here from Stearns. This is not an endorsement of same-sex marriage. We have decided we are not going in get into that debate. Nor is this a rejection of traditional marriage, which we affirm and support. Now, of course, in one sense, it wouldn't be. Nobody's rejecting traditional marriage in the sense that traditional marriage is an option. But when one, can I say this? He says I don't endorse it, but that's what they've done. When we are hiring gay Christians in same-sex marriages, while they still make this ethical demands, and I'm flipping the pages trying to find it, the ethical demands that that those who are involved in their organization still maintain a high degree of moral purity in their conduct. And again, I'm summarizing because I'm looking for the exact wording here. I got a lot of papers in front of me. Then it's clear to me that they think that homosexual behavior, at least within the confines of a same-sex union, is not immoral behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So they are weighing in on homosexuality and on same-sex marriage at the same time, because same-sex marriage makes a difference to the morality of the conduct as far as they're concerned. And that's so how could this not be an endorsement of same-sex marriage? Now, I think what's going on here, and this is Amy Hall's observation as well, the claim by World Vision, why are they doing this? They say that they're not being threatened by the government. In fact, they have successfully fought the government in things kind of like this all the way to the Supreme Court. So they're willing to fight City Hall on things kind of like this. She says, no, it's not an external thing at all. But they did mention here that the board and I wanted to prevent this divisive issue from tearing World Vision apart and potentially crippling our ability to accomplish our vital kingdom mission of loving and serving the poorest of the poor in the name of Christ. So something apparently has been going on inside of World Vision that they see as potentially debilitating. And the refrain that is sung over and over and over here, Todd, in this world, this Christianity Today article, is that the reason that they're doing this is to promote Christian unity. Did you see that?
Yes, no, I did. I had seen that in the article.
So, okay, what do you mean Christian unity? There's so much division on the same-sex marriage issue, they have decided to hire same-sex couples who have actually been married to promote Christian unity. Now, Todd, does that make any sense to you?
No.
How changing their policy is going to increase Christian unity. The divide on this issue is like the Grand Canyon. And they somehow think they're going to bring both sides together by changing horses in the middle of the stream in a way that makes no sense ethically or morally or biblically. Now, the way they are trying to position this move, Todd, is they are saying that there are many things that the church disagrees on that we're just not going to weigh in on. You know, the rapture and whether you dip a baby or sprinkle a baby in baptism, or whether you baptize babies at all, and divorce and remarriage, and women in ministry. And there are all kinds of things that we are just not going to take a position on at World Vision. We're going to let the local church hammer that out. Okay, fair enough. Those are things that you can be silent on and don't have. I can see how none of those things, or I should say your silence on any of those things, silence which betokens official neutrality, has any influence in anything you do. That seems to make sense to me. But what if you said, we are not going to take any position on the controversial issue of ordaining women in ministry? And in order to show our neutrality and to create harmony based in virtue of this conflict and division we have in the body of Christ, we have just ordained 100 women to head up chapels around the world. And that is not an endorsement of ordaining women. That is just simply an effort that we have taken to create Christian unity. Now, if they did that, Todd, wouldn't that, isn't that ridiculous? Wouldn't it obviously be the case that they are endorsing one side? And I don't see how that's any different than what they've done with same-sex marriage. Yes, we are going to hire homosexuals who are in same-sex marriages, and this is not to be taken in any way, shape, or form as an endorsement of the legitimacy of same-sex marriage. I mean, here's the phrase that comes to mind, Todd. How stupid does he think we are? This is not an endorsement. They think they're going to sit out on the sidelines of this conversation by doing this. Now, probably what happened, Todd, and I don't know if this has occurred to you or not, Amy had this observation. Again, I want to give credit where credit's due, but what probably happened, given that they're in Washington State and Washington has same-sex marriage laws, that they were not looking for practicing homosexuals. It's like a no-ask, don't-ask, don't-tell policy, I imagine. But then when they pass the law, then they have people within their ranks that are actually getting married because the state law allows them to do that. Now what are they going to do with people inside their organization? Well, I guess we just won't do anything. Well, wait a minute. If you won't do anything and therefore you have same-sex marriages within your organization, how are you going to now say no to couples involved in a same-sex marriage? And it pains me to even use the phrase because I do believe it's an oxymoron, that same-sex doesn't belong in the same sentence with the word marriage because marriage isn't that kind of thing. Can't just redefine it and it changes its meaning. It's a feature of reality. It's the way nature is structured. In any event, since we have people inside, we can't deny this to people who want to come inside. So now we have to affirm that this is okay. And the alternative is some kind of destructive division within their organization that is grounded in their claim that, and again, I'll find it here if I keep looking, that we are encouraging others to live morally pure lives, and this is something important to our values. And so, if I guess it's not morally impure as long as their conduct is somehow sanctified by a marriage certificate the state has given them. That's all I can tell. The reason this is disheartening for me, Todd, is that there doesn't seem to me to be any really good reason for them to do this. As they pointed out, there is no pressure from the outside. The government isn't requiring this. They don't have any lawsuit against them, or so they claim. But they do hint at a tearing of world vision apart from the inside, which means they have disaffected people who work for them that are going to be bugged if they don't adopt this policy. Now, why isn't it that World Vision can't just say, since we require as a non-negotiable that people be steadfast followers of Christ and homosexual behavior is inconsistent with being a steadfast follower of Christ and same-sex marriage institutionally legitimizes homosexual sexual behavior, therefore we cannot go along with this. And if you are in our organization and this is your situation, you need to find another place to work because, by golly, we stand for something here at World Vision. But as it turns out, apparently what they don't stand for is moral purity on this issue. And since they don't stand for moral purity on this issue, they are willing to say, if you get a license, then we're good with that, which means it isn't the homosexuality per se that's a problem. It's just doing it without a marriage license, just like any other sexual behavior.
They say that on the first page.
Pardon me? Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, yeah, I'm glad you did.
They say basically that on the first page, just as it also allows us to treat all of our employees the same way. Abstinence outside of marriage and fidelity within marriage.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that just kind of reaffirms what you just said.
That's right. So as you can only say fidelity inside of marriage if you endorse same-sex marriage as a legitimate marriage in which the homosexuality is a faithful example of appropriate sexual behavior in that institution. For them to talk about we're not endorsing this out of the other side of their mouth, to me, is utterly disingenuous. So this brings me to your question, Todd, and that has to do with donating to I think we're just going to skip that first break, Tom. Sorry, I've been talking and we rolled right through it. But should a Christian donate to a Christian organization that that serves the poor but accepts same-sex marriage? My answer is very simple. I would not. I would not. In good conscience, I couldn't do this. Is World Vision doing good work in other areas? In their fulfilling their mission, yes, they're doing fabulous work as far as I could tell. But this is not a good sign. Now, they say this isn't a slippery slope. We're just making a little adjustment. What we care about is the unity of the body of Christ. This is hogwash. I cannot take that seriously for a split second because this what they did has not promoted any unity. And for them to say that you can just be neutral on this issue is like saying you can be neutral regarding slavery. You don't want to have a slave? Don't own one. Other people want to have slaves? They can own them. We're neutral. Well, no one would say that with regards to slavery. Same problem with abortion. You don't want to have an abortion? Don't have one. You want to have one? You can have one. We're neutral. No, you're not neutral. In both cases, having an abortion or being or slavery are legitimate options in the choices. And so one has weighed in with a point of view there. And the same thing is true here. They're saying that that same-sex marriage is a legitimate expression of marriage. When in their statement of faith, they say, here it is, we believe the Bible to be the inspired, only infallible, authoritative word of God. I take the word infallible there in their meaning to be inerrant. Infallible could mean other things. I don't think they're onto that. So I think they mean it. That's a high view. And then they say, we believe in the deity of our Lord Jesus Christ, etc., who, by the way, said from the beginning, it has been this way. Male and female, he created them, and the two are joined together, they become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. He's talking there about divorce. But divorce is a feature of marriage. So the topic is marriage, and marriage has always been between a man and a woman. That's Jesus, the divine Son of God, speaking in the authoritative, inspired, infallible, inerrant word of God. If that's in their statement of faith, why don't they take that seriously? Now, I'll tell you why they don't take it seriously, because different denominations have different interpretations of same-sex marriage, and therefore nobody knows. Well, different denominations have different interpretations about virtually every single thing under the sun, including every item on their statement of faith. So why don't they just say nobody knows there and it isn't so critical? Well, it's not in the Apostles' Creed. It's not in the Apostles' Creed because no one in the first century would have countenanced the idea of same-sex marriage. They didn't keep bestiality out of the Apostles' Creed either because that this wasn't an important thing. Nobody countenanced that kind of thing as part of the Christian life. Now we have to be a little bit more careful. Incidentally, after the Apostles' Creed, there was the Nicene Creed because too many heretics could sign off on the Apostles' Creed. It wasn't adequate. And this is the case nowadays. So I'm troubled, Todd, principally because we have a major organization who has been willing to step up and fight for Christians, and they have the financial wherewithal to be a player here and keep the LGBT crowd from bullying other Christians. And what are they doing? Even without a fight, they're giving this up. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be in our court on this. They're giving it up. They're going along with it, and I think it's a preemptive move so that they can stay away from trouble in the future, especially trouble from within their own ranks. And instead of toeing the line and saying, we stand for something, they've said here, well, it's our mission is central. Wait a minute. Mission is always, informed by values. So they want to reach the poor, but at any cost? No, we have values that restrain the way we go about this. And so your values are supposed to be part of this. And frankly, what I've read of their values, I like. It doesn't inform this particular decision because they think that a faithful follower of Jesus Christ can be an active homosexual.
Uh-huh.
Oh, goodness. And so this is a battle that we have right now, Todd, and we just have a major player that has just gone over to the other side on this. An organization, what is their I'm looking for the amount of money they bring in. Billions. I mean, it's a huge, massive organization that could do so good, so much good for us on this issue. And now they're just giving it up. They're just waving the white flag. And it, with a weenie reason. We just want to promote unity. We just think there's so much division in the body of Christ about this issue that we just decided to do this to promote unity. What, promote unity? Just think of all the people that enraged. And then, at the end, let's see, let me just, I'm looking at all the exclamation points I've written in the text here, so, because I can't believe what I'm reading. It's like, can you believe that? I hope it, if it's symbolic of anything, Stearns says, it is symbolic of how we can come together even though we disagree. We, meaning other Christians, are not the enemy. We have to find a way to come together around core beliefs to accomplish the mission that Christ has given to his church. Well, of course, I agree with that in principle. But what are the core beliefs? And this issue of homosexuality, though I understand it's not in any of the creeds because it was never an issue, but it has become the issue of the day. It's become the watershed issue of, I think, integrity and fidelity to Christ. We feel positive about what we've done. Our motives are pure. We're not doing this because of outside pressure. We're doing this. We're not doing this to get more revenue. We're really doing this because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do. And it's the right thing to do for the unity within the church. I'm hoping this may inspire unity among others as well, to say how we can come together across our some differences and still join together as brothers and sisters in Christ as our common mission in building the kingdom. Well, you know, there were some other places. Where is that? I wrote the word passive-aggressive. Here it is. I urge each one of you to respect the heartfelt wisdom of our board and to fix your eyes on Jesus. Oh, come on. It was Jesus. This is the kind of stuff that annoys the heck out of me, Todd. You know, this kind of language. Oh, dear brothers and sisters, let us be one on this. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Yeah, you know, that phrase, fix your eyes on Jesus, is from Hebrews 12. And that's where it says, casting off the sin which so easily entangles us and fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. In other words, he paid the price that he needed to pay to do what was right. So now we're asked to go along with this and fix our eyes on Jesus. In his eyes, you will see his deep love for the poor and his deep love for you and each one of your co-workers. All right. Great. You can't, some of these things you can't parody anymore, Todd. You just can't, you know. It's like, that's kind of like this bizarre thing, and you can't think of anything more bizarre. This is like as bizarre as it gets, it seems. Anyway, I work for Food for the Hungry in Thailand in 1982, and for 7 months there, working in a hunger program in a Cambodian refugee camp. And I'm sure that they have a good sponsorship program, and I don't think they've made this kind of move. If somebody is a sponsor of a World Vision child, I know there's a relationship there that you have and a commitment that you've made to that child. I think you should see your commitment through. And after that, I hope you would consider sending your money to a different organization, and there are lots of them out there that are committed Christians and are not asking you to live with this dissonant ethical viewpoint that we are faithful followers of Christ, yet it promote or endorse in some way same-sex marriage and the institutional homosexual behavior that goes along with that. I, for one, would send my money elsewhere if my commitment with a particular child was up. And I hope people do. This maddens me because this issue matters. And every time another Christian organization folds to the pressure. And they said they weren't pressured. If they weren't pressured, for goodness sake, then why are they making this ridiculous move? Something's pressuring them, and I do not buy their claim to promote unity, because this is creating all kinds of disunity. You're not going to bring this divide together. You're either for or again on this one. And there's no middle ground, and they have staked their claim already for with their behavior, in spite of the comments to the contrary. Todd, I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, that's great, and I especially appreciate the word about seeing the current commitment through, to completion. Mm-hmm. That helps provide a lot of clarity.
Yeah, so, commitment's a commitment, and since you made that commitment to a child, even through the auspices of World Vision, then I think you should fulfill that. But
thanks so much, and all the best to y'all.
All right, thank you, Todd. I appreciate your call, and give me a chance to bend your ear or burn your ear, as the case may be, on that issue. Quick to break, and then back with more on Stand to Reason.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that will help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that will help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that will help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market. And start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
All right, Greg Kokel here, and I have it on his front page of the CT article. World Vision's American branch will no longer require its more than 1,100 employees to restrict their sexual activity to marriage between one man and one woman. Abstinence outside of marriage remains a rule, but a policy change announced Monday will now permit gay Christians and legal same-sex marriages to be employed at one of America's largest Christian charities. Okay, got it. Abstinence outside of marriage remains a rule. Why? Because the Bible requires appropriate sexual conduct. It doesn't require – the conduct that it requires is not simply sex inside of marriage, but rather sex between a husband and wife. And there's a difference. Because if you say sex – what the Bible teaches is sex inside of marriage. No, it's not what it teaches. It's more precise than that. It teaches sex between a husband and a wife, a man and a woman. And so if you have a same-sex union that the government gives a license for, that does not change the moral nature of the behavior. I'm thinking to myself, no duh, this is not rocket science. Why don't these guys get it? Anyway. All right, time to move on to something else, unless somebody calls and wants to talk about it more. Let's go to Ann in somewhere in Oklahoma. Ann, hi, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, thank you for having me on the show.
Sure, welcome to the show. Can you speak up just a little bit? I'm having a hard time hearing you. Maybe move in closer to the mouthpiece.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know why I thought
no,
you left enough.
That was a big improvement.
Oh, good. My question, now this is based on experience I had when I was a kid. How can one discern between God's direct intervention and superstition?
Well, that's a good question, and I had been thinking about it since your little sign went up here. Melinda put it up with your question on it, and I a couple things came immediately to mind. Superstition is when one ascribes meaning to something that the thing doesn't have, or possibly power to something that the thing doesn't have. So believing in the power of a rabbit's foot would be superstitious because, as my father used to say, the rabbit had four of them, and look at where he ended up. Or ascribing meaning or significance to things that may be just coincidence. So how do you know when there's a providential act or something coincidental? And I think one way is just the, I had written down the word significance, but maybe that needs more clarification. I believe there are lots of coincidences in the world. That is, there are things that just happen at the same time. They are coincidents. And there is no meaning that should be applied to their coincidental nature. However, there are times when there are things that are done, that happen, that seem to be, for the lack of a better word, a designed kind of thing. That there is, as we look back on the nature of the event and what took place, it seemed to clearly fit into a larger pattern. Now, it may not be something that we can figure out or see immediately, but we look back over time and we see it. Let me just think of an example from my own life where I received a phone call. Oh, here's a better one. I've talked about this a lot. I talk about a young lady that I met on a bus who shared Christ with me before I was a Christian. It was the summer of 1973, who made an offhanded remark about a Bible study in Westwood Village near UCLA, which I completely ignored because I wasn't a Christian, so why would I go to a Bible study? And as it turned out, though I never saw her again, I remembered that after I became a Christian and found where that Bible study was. It turned out to be a Christian community that I moved into and lived with for about 2.5 years. And this completely, I should say, established the trajectory of my Christian life. So it was not an inconsequential at all, but it seemed, at least initially, to be something that was in it was just coincidental. So here's a young long-haired guy, you know, talking to this girl on the bus, and she says a few things. They part and never see each other again. Okay. Coincidence? Well, not in this case, because we see what God worked out. So I think that in the moment, it's difficult to be able to know whether something was just two things happening at the same time without any meaning attached to them, coincidence, or that there was something else going on. You can't tell that in a moment, but if you look back, you can see God's hand clearly working. And that was the case with this young lady. Her name was Adrienne Thatcher. Never forgotten her name. But I never saw her after that day. Still haven't. So I don't know in your case, Anne, what the nature of the event was, but I guess I would ask you to look back now and see whether that event played any significant part in a larger scheme of things as far as you can tell. If it seems to have, then I think it's fair to say that this was not coincidental. It was an act of God's providence in virtue of this plan. And if it seems not to be part of anything bigger, I think it's fair to say that it was probably just a coincidence. I'll give you one other example, and then I want to hear from you. I was praying many years ago while I was driving, and I was single at the time, and I was praying about the upcoming Christmas holidays because I thought, you know, I wasn't looking forward to them. Christmas was kind of lonely time for a single guy, as is for lots of single folk, and so I was trying to get myself prepared for that and asking God to make something special of this next Christmas for me. And you know how it is when you're driving and you're thinking about something or praying or having a conversation, your body is in auto control and you're driving properly, but you're not really aware of what's in front of you, right?
Yes.
Okay, so in this particular case, I'm on the 405 freeway around Carson, and when my eyes adjust to the reality around me after I've just completed my prayer to God about Christmas, I notice the license plate of a car that is driving past me. I mean, it's about the first thing that I really noticed clearly after the prayer. And the license plate was a personalized plate that had on it XMAS, the number 4, and the letter U. Christmas for you.
Huh.
Now, I had been just praying about Christmas for me, and there was a Christmas for you. Now, it had occurred to me that this might be a providential sign of some sort. Maybe God is, it certainly seemed oddly coincidental, wouldn't you say?
Yes, very much so.
Well, it turned out that there was nothing special about this Christmas in my life, and in fact, it was as bad as the previous ones had been and difficult and maybe worse. So after this thing played out, it turns out I had no reason to think there was any significance to this license plate, all right, that in fact it was coincidental. I have actually had Christians say to me, regarding that illustration, because I've mentioned this in talks before, they were so committed to the idea that there was a message being communicated by God in that license plate, they said to me, maybe you had a wonderful Christmas, but you didn't know it.
Mm.
Well, what's the good of having a wonderful Christmas if you don't know you had a wonderful Christmas, you know? But they were trying to save the paradigm. They were trying to find meaning in it. I just take that as a ludicrous statement. You can't have a wonderful Christmas and not know it. The meaning of wonderful has to do with how you experience it, you know. And if I didn't experience it that way, then I didn't have it that way. It's as simple as that. But there's an example of something that that seemed dramatically significant but turned out to be inconsequential, entirely inconsequential. So I take it as a bona fide coincidence. So there you have an example from my life in either direction. But I think the key factor is being able to look back and see whether some larger plan played out of that event. So what think you about your own circumstance now in light of that?
It's very helpful. Well, the story that I have, when I was a very young child, we were headed out somewhere, but my parents had two separate cars at that time,
mm-hmm.
and I got in the front seat with my mom, and last minute, I decided I wanted to ride with my dad instead to listen to oldies, which I absolutely hated.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way, my mother got T-boned by a drunk driver
right
where I was sitting, and it wasn't until years later that I realized that was probably God.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd be willing... Look, when in doubt, give God credit. That's my view. And I'll tell you why. Because we have a very well-justified world view in which God plays a really significant providential role. Okay? So if my kids came home one night from school and my wife wasn't there, but there was food on the table, they would be justified in believing that it was mom and not the mailman who did it.
Right.
Because it fits into their larger understanding of reality that is well justified. And by the same token, when quirky things like that happen, and we have reason to believe that there is a benevolent God who is watching over us and keeping us and protecting us, which God, by the way, communicated in his word that there are angels that watch over children.
That, yes.
Did I get that right? There's a place in Hebrews that talks about entertaining angels unaware. Yeah, there's because his angels looks on. There's another passage. The angels look over the little ones. And so then for you to just, in a sense, serendipitously get out of the car and get into another car and then have your mom T-boned right there at the spot where you were sitting, for you to conclude something bigger is going on here, I think is entirely justified. Can you know that with a certainty? Well, that may be out of reach, but I think you're certainly justified in concluding that.
Thank you so much.
Well, Anne, I'm glad to have a chance to talk with you and hear this story, and also to kind of work out just my own thoughts on this coincidence providence business. All right. Thanks so much for your call. Let's see. Let's look at talk with Dave in San Diego and see if we can get this in under the wire here. Dave, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. Good. Thanks.
Good.
What's up?
Bear with me if any background noise comes. It's my 5-month-old son who has not had a nap all day.
Oh. Hey, that's bad news.
Yeah, it's bad news. Coincidentally, I'm calling about good news, specifically the good news of the gospel. And I have a former coworker, former as of last week. She had put in her 2 weeks notice and moved on. She's raised Catholic, but that's about the extent of her quote unquote religious background.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have been noticing in her life she has a lot of sadness, friends around her dying, and she's asking questions, why is this stuff happening?
Mm-hmm.
So I have tried my best to gently give her my take on it from a Christian perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I've begun reading the tactics book, and I started using the tactics with her, but did not get much of a chance.
Mm-hmm.
When she left this past weekend.
Okay, Dave, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll pick you up at the beginning of next hour, which is just a couple minutes away. Is that okay?
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, because I want to hear what you have to say. Now, am I pushing the top button to put him on hold? Okay, stay with us. There you are. Okay, that's it for hour number two. And if you like where your curiosity was piqued by Dave's comments, we'll be back with him when we return on Stand to Reason. All right, friends, final hour here. I got caught scarfing a biscotti during the break, and I wasn't quite finished, so a little slow on the uptake. A lot of callers on board, and I have opined excessively in the last segment on the World Vision. Can I just call it a fiasco? I think it's a moral fiasco. I read the entire CT article. I read the entire statement offered by World Vision. I read their statement of faith, the whole thing, and it does not add up. And it obviously does not add up. And given the fact that this is a huge battle that we are fighting, and there is division on the church, and this is why we can't have people like World Vision going the wrong direction on this same-sex marriage issue. We need this, you know, 500-pound gorilla on our side. They have fought this issue with the government successfully in the past, or issues like it, and then for them to surrender, wave the white flag for no, well, they have their reasons, but let me say no good reason, no good moral reason, no convincing reason that they stated. You wonder what's going on behind the scenes. That is the real issue. Look, when they give their stated reasons and no thoughtful person can accept that as the legitimate reasons. Nobody can. I'm just, maybe that sounds self-serving. We did this for the sake of Christian unity. We are promoting, well, they say they're not promoting. We are acknowledging, hiring same-sex married couples in our organization, which demands that everybody be a faithful follower of Christ. That is not an endorsement of same-sex marriage on the one hand, and an acknowledgement that being a practicing homosexual is fully consistent with being a faithful follower of Christ. You don't see that? Okay, enough. Let's go back to Dave in San Diego. And Dave, you had called at the end of last hour, and we just got rolling a little bit, talking about your friend who was down and out and having a difficult time. And so you engage in a conversation with her to try to encourage her, and that's where we left it.
Right, right. And unfortunately, it was limited because we were coworkers, and that's the extent of our time together. And being that she's female and I'm a married man, I don't feel comfortable getting together with her one-on-one, you know, outside of taking a walk around our building at lunchtime. So our time together was limited and then cut off abruptly by her leaving our company. And immediately upon leaving our company, she was going to something called the Landmark Forum. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Well, Warner Erhard is involved with that.
Yep.
Is that? Yeah.
Yep.
He's I'm not familiar with this new form of it. I think he's kind of a new age guy. I'm trying to recall. He had a couple of other seminar forum enterprises
yeah.
that went by other names in the past,
yeah.
Within the last 20 or 30 years. And so
right.
sometimes
anything
these guys...
Anything that you remember about it is going to be more or less true about Landmark from what I've
yeah, they
learned
just,
in my research.
They recycle the same teachings under a mm-hmm. different guise and with a different
mm-hmm.
title. So I can't even remember. Erhard Seminar Trainings or something it was called. And
ERD.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, whatever. So so your
well,
concern in this case so, is?
Yeah, I felt like I had an opportunity to make some headway to, you know, to fill in the gap. She is sad. She's wondering why the world is the way it is. I start to introduce the gospel. She seems, you know, to be nibbling on the bait, for lack of a better term.
Uh-huh.
And then she lands herself in this forum, and I texted her the day after it was over, and I said, "How did it go?" She said, "Oh, my gosh, it changed my life, revolutionized everything. You know, all my wrongs have been righted. And now I feel like I have nowhere to you know, insert Jesus into the
yeah,
picture."
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that this last caller, just before you last hour, was asking questions about coincidences and divine providences. Well,
right.
there are other spiritual forces at work here than
right.
God, and this doesn't seem to me to be a coincidence at all.
Yeah.
And it may be that that opportunity was snatched away from you, not through any fault of your own.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just roll with these things. I don't know if you have an opportunity to loosely stay connected with her. You might get in touch with her in a couple of months, and the glow from Warner Erhard will have worn off.
Oh, that's a good point. In one of our conversations, she had talked about a youth camp she had been invited to by someone, and I am involved in Young Life, and mm-hmm. I know that you can get a camp high that sticks yeah. around for a couple of weeks and then kind of burns off if nobody follows up. And
yeah.
she mentioned that she had something similar like that. So
well, they'll probably follow up with her because they want more of her money.
That's true.
You know, so, but I would, I just try to stay in touch. And this woman doesn't need self-help. She needs God's help.
That's exactly right.
And I don't know if that's even a way you can put it to her if you talk to her, and that
yeah.
you want to talk to her about God's help, because, you know, we get self-help and we are going to fail ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
God is not going to fail us. He's bigger than we are. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, that might be a way to approach a conversation with her.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And like I said, I'm about halfway through tactics, and I literally rushed to buy it quickly. I was intending on buying it, but I thought, I'm going to be talking to this coworker.
Uh-huh.
I need to, you know, get right into this.
Sure.
So I hope to get practice elsewhere, and maybe I put a stone in her shoe. I don't know.
Good for you. I know you'll have an opportunity to use what you're learning. So
stay
with
it. Thanks, Greg.
All right. You're welcome, Dave. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And Covina, California, Aaron, welcome. Hello, Aaron.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, I'm a college student, and I'm looking to transfer, hopefully, to Biola.
Uh-huh.
And so I was looking at their program, and one that I'm really interested in is their intercultural studies program.
Uh-huh.
And so I was just wondering if, just what your thoughts were on that, and if that's just a beneficial degree, or just what you thought.
Well,
about.
What is it that you're interested in accomplishing yourself when you consider your studies at a university?
Well, I don't know. I know I'm passionate about missions, and I feel like that's an area that God's gifted me in.
Mm-hmm.
This past summer I was in Africa for 2 months, and I just absolutely loved it.
Mm.
And so,
whereabouts in Africa?
Malawi.
Mm-hmm.
And so just looking to transfer and just trying to, I mean, just a lot of college students trying to look for, you know, just a major, and this is one that kind of caught my eye. And I was
okay. Well, let me just give you a little perspective on my view of education. When I went to Northern Illinois, Michigan State, UCLA, Azusa Pacific. So in my undergraduate, I had 4 different colleges that I went to. And I finally graduated from Azusa. And this was back in 1977 that I graduated there. So it's been a while. But my even before I was a Christian, the first 3 schools, I wasn't a Christian. I became a Christian at UCLA. My perspective on education was that I valued education for education's sake. I didn't know that I was going to kind of nail some kind of career that matched my education at the time. And so given the fact that lots of times we do go through an educational program and we end up going in a different direction than at least our undergraduate studies were concerned, I don't think you have to worry too much about kind of answering the question, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? And I better get a program that will help that or move me in that direction. I think pursuing your interests is a fabulous way of moving forward. If you're interested in intercultural studies, if you're interested in spending time overseas, then something like a program at Biola might be really good if those are where your interests are at. You may not end up being a full-time missionary. You may do some short-term missions work. You may just be expanded personally and intellectually and spiritually by the education and experiences that you have at Biola if you go in that program, and then pursue an entirely different line in graduate school or in work or something like that. I think the important thing is, especially since you're young and you don't have a lot of obligations now, that you follow your interests. And there's nothing wrong with I mean, if you want to pursue the intercultural studies, Biola is as good a place as any to pursue it. I have the highest regard for the institution. I work there, you know, as an adjunct faculty in their graduate program with Dr. Hazen in apologetics. But one of the benefits for Biola, and given that a lot of good Christian schools sometimes wander, it is really great that Biola has a graduate program not only in theology but also in philosophy, because I think that that provides a kind of a tiller or a keel for the organization. If anybody in the undergraduate division starts to get a little off base, there are forces in the graduate program, in both theological and philosophical, that are able to put pressure on, appropriate pressure, and get the ship, so to speak, back on course. So this is a great advantage to being at Biola, in my view. And that sometimes you see things in the undergrad programs, and I think a number of years ago, I ran into something that bothered me a lot, and it was a little bit of a postmodern influence in some of the teaching there, and maybe it was in the intercultural studies, I'm not sure. But I remember the conversation very clearly, the instructor telling the students in this class that there are two kinds of truth. There is capital T truth, and there is small t truth. And the capital T truth is truth as God knows it, and only God knows capital T truth, and the rest of us have small t truth. That is like our subjective truth. And therefore, you know, we have to keep in mind our limitations, because and I think it had to do with, you know, pushing our views on other people or something like that. And I, what troubled me is that the view I took it as was clearly self-refuting, because my question to this professor was, I mean, in absentia, I just heard about this, so I didn't ask it of her, but I role-played this out. My question is, this statement that you just made about the two kinds of truth, is this statement itself an example of the large T truth or small T truth? If it's the large T truth, you just told me I could know that, only God knows that. If it's the small T truth, it's relativistic, so why should I care? But anyway, the teacher didn't seem to have, this didn't dawn on her, and the students are taking notes like mad, you know, like, is this going to be on the final? And they're not thinking about what's being told them. So this issue, I think, got resolved, though, over there. And partly because you've got graduate school watchdogs kind of helping out. And I'm not saying that the undergrad doesn't have integrity. It does. But it's just always good when you have more people in the mix that can kind of keep the ship on the tried and true. And I think that's true about Biola. So, you know, I think that you're pursuing a noble enterprise. You may want to look at online and in their catalog and see exactly what the intercultural program provides. I mean, precisely, what are its goals? What are the courses that will be taught that you have to take? What are the, who are the teachers? Maybe you'll recognize some names of the courses, and then you say, do I want to spend my money on this course of action? And I think it's an individual decision at that point. If you have a passion for it, there's no reason not to pursue it. And so if you get a degree in intercultural studies and you say, gee, I don't really like that, I want to go somewhere else, it's no big deal. It's no big deal. You can do that. I want to do something else, you can do that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to take a lot of things, different things into account, and just trying to make a good decision.
Yeah.
And I know that's like an interest of mine. I just kind of wanted to know what you thought about it.
I'm in favor of people following their interests as long as it doesn't collide with another biblical principle that's really weighty. You know, sometimes we do make foolish decisions and we kind of go off on a wing and a prayer, I guess is the phrase, and instead of thinking a little bit more carefully about it. But, I mean, what you've told me so far is fine. I don't know if Biola costs some cash, so, you know, that's always a consideration. But if you can graduate from Biola, that is in any department, I think you're getting a great degree for yourself, because it's not just the intercultural studies that you're going to be taking, but you're taking along with it other classes, other courses, other relationships that you're building in a community that I think is a first-rate Christian community.
So you think the viewpoint of the university that you're going to, like, say I was to you know, study intercultural studies, but say at a more secular, a secular school.
Uh-huh.
Does the viewpoint, would my decision kind of change?
Well, you're going to get taught from the perspective of a different worldview. So if you go to a secular school, I don't even know if you can, well, the intercultural studies is going to look entirely different. It's going to be pluralistic. It's going to be multicultural. The idea that one culture is better than the other, you know, this is wildly politically incorrect, especially if you think, if you believe in American exceptionalism, you're going to be persona non grata in that environment, you know. Like, who are you, weirdo, that thinks America's special and better than other people? If anything, we're worse than other people, and that's what you're going to get. I have no sense that you're going to get trained to be effective communicator in another culture for the cause of Christ. You are going to be discouraged in doing that. So what would be the benefit that you would gain from a secular school? Maybe it's a little cheaper, but you're going there to get an education. If price were prohibitive, you just go to a junior college. Don't go to college, you know. You're there to get an education. So if you save some money and then get the wrong kind of education, what good is that? You haven't saved money. You've wasted money, in my view. I'm not saying no Christian should ever go to a secular school, but in the area you're interested in, I don't see how you're going to accomplish your goal at a secular school. You're going to get the opposite.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
All right, Aaron. Give us a call somewhere down the line. Tell us what you decided and how it's working out, okay?
All right. Appreciate it, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call. Let's go to break right now, and then we'll come back with Chris in Virginia Beach, John in Sacramento, and Serge in Ontario. Look forward to those calls coming up.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show with you every Tuesday night live. If you want to call in the live show, 4 to 7, Tuesday, Los Angeles time, 855-243-9975. By the way, we're on TV. I've been talking about this on and off the last few months. Airing on the NRB Network, National Religious Broadcasters. It's a TV network that features lots of Christian content. And we're glad to be part of that lineup. You can catch us Wednesday nights, 11 p.m. Pacific time. That would be like 2 p.m. Eastern time, right? And Thursdays, 2 a.m. Eastern. It can be seen on DirecTV Channel 378, Sky Angel Channel 181, and Google Play and Roku. So there you have it. Let's see. Did we lose somebody? We did. I even just said their name that we're going to get to them. Well, let's go to Virginia Beach, talk with Chris. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Glad you called.
Excellent. Thanks. Hey, I'll apologize in advance. I hope the loud clicking noise that I'm hearing in the background on my end of the phone is not disturbing you. But,
okay.
I've noticed it since I've been on the hold.
I haven't heard it yet. You're coming through loudly and clearly here for me, so that's a good sign.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Hey, okay, so I'm working through a reading through the Bible in 1 year plan, and working my way through a lot of the Old Testament law right now. And something I've been wondering, just if you could talk a little bit about how do we know which parts of the Old Testament morality code, maybe, or the different parts of the Old Covenant might still apply and which ones might not, and
right.
maybe draw a parallel in that reasoning to things in the New Testament.
Right.
I've just been seeing some stuff that, like, in there's a passage in 1 Corinthians 11 about how women should pray with their heads covered and men should pray with their heads uncovered. Is that kind of stuff, like, cultural?
Yeah.
Or is it something that should be relevant to today? How do we know which things apply today and which things don't?
Let's stick with Moses for the time being, because that's a harder... The New Testament calls are more difficult.
Gotcha.
And I think that particular passage is hard to make sense out of. So I'm just I won't go there now. But I think the Old Testament passages are much easier to deal with in this regard, that they fall under the umbrella of a covenant relationship between God and Israel. Now, a covenant, do you know what a synonym for covenant would be?
A contract.
Perfect. A contract. So God made an agreement with the Jews, and it was actually a very particular kind of agreement. We see this in Leviticus, some in Exodus, but mostly in Leviticus. And then we see that law repeated in Deuteronomy. The word Deuteronomy is deuteronomos, means second law. And that is, it's this. It wasn't until about 10 years ago that this became obvious to me, but Deuteronomy is the second time the law is given, because there is a space of 40 years between the first giving of the law, the second giving of the law, and that's the wandering in the wilderness. And during that time, one whole generation dies off and a whole new generation is brought up. So they need to be reacquainted with the law before they go into the land. And the way the law is expressed, especially there in its second giving, is in the form of a contract, or a treaty, actually. And it's an ancient suzerain vassal treaty, the suzerain being the great king and the vassal being the vassal, you know, the servant of the great king. And what they had a certain form, and you can see this form in the expression of the law there. Essentially, what the form stated was that the king rescued the vassal people, and therefore the vassal people have an obligation to serve the king. And if they serve the king and they pay taxes and they fight in his battles, then the king will take care of the vassal, will protect the vassal and provide for the vassal state. And if they don't, then it's big trouble. Well, you see this exact same form in this treaty with the Jews, and you have I am the God who took you out of Egypt and brought you out and rescued you. So I'm the great king that to who you owe, and so here's the deal. And he lays out his law, and then in Deuteronomy 28 through 30, we have the blessings and cursings. If you keep the law, I will bless you. If you disobey, then I curse. So you have this treaty, this contract that God has made with the Jews. Now, here's why I cast this out with regards to your first question, and that is, since God made the treaty with the Jews, it does not apply as a treaty to anyone who was not a signatory. He did not make this treaty with Gentiles. He made this treaty with Jews. He did not make this contract with all the nations of the world. He made it with one nation of the world to accomplish a particular goal with that nation. And there's a number of things going on with the Mosaic Covenant. Some of it is organizing this country that God has birthed out of the loins of Abraham. So you have civil laws that are in that contract. Some of it is to keep them protected from being syncretistic with the other religious cultures around them. And so there are very, very odd laws that pertain to things that really are meant to keep a cultural distinction between the Jews and the heathen Canaanite religions in the ancient Middle East. So in one way, this law becomes a wall that is meant to separate out the Jewish people from those Canaanite religions. And see, all of these are purposes of this law that are unique to the nation of Israel, and that's why the law is made with the nation of Israel for a period of time. Now, later on, as you're reading through, once you get to like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, this is a different period of time. This is the time of the maybe 500, 600, 700 BC. So 1,000 years have passed since the giving of the Mosaic Law, in that, there is discipline coming and has been on Israel. The northern kingdom is gone. The southern kingdom is going to be carried away by Nebuchadnezzar. These are all outworkings of the promises and the blessings, and I'm sorry, the cursings of the Mosaic contract. They promise that there will be a new contract, and that's called the New Covenant. It's Jeremiah 31, verse 31 and following. And it describes this, and also in Ezekiel, so it describes this new relationship, which he specifies there, not like the one that God made with you when you came out of Egypt, that covenant which you broke, but a new covenant. Now, here's what I want you to see, and I know this may sound like a tedious way of getting around to answering your question, but I think you're going to see that it's going to make dealing with the issues that you raise, the questions you raised about what are the role of different parts in the Old Testament or the Mosaic Covenant to us today, it's going to make this very, very, a whole lot easier to answer if you understand it's the intended purpose of it. The Mosaic Covenant was a contract with a group of people for a period of time, which contract they broke, and so God ordained a new contract that would be for the people, an unbreakable contract that would not just extend to the Jews, but would extend to all peoples. This, the new contract, would have provisions that would ultimately be the fulfillment of the very first contract, which is with Abraham. And that provision was that through Abraham, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. If it turns out that I'm right about the Mosaic Covenant being a contract with the Jews, and just with them, for a finite period of time, after which a new contract would take precedence, then, simply put, nothing that is in the Mosaic Covenant applies to us today in virtue of it being in the Mosaic Covenant. So we don't have all the laws that pertain to dietary things and sacrificial things. The diet laws were changed. Jesus heralded that. No more sacrificial opportunity. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD. That whole system is defunct. So we do not go anywhere in the Mosaic Law to find directives or commands that we are to follow. That law was not a contract with us. You got me so far? Are you with me so far?
Yep, okay. Absolutely. Just listening. So yeah. I'm soaking it in.
Okay, so now, but then this raises another question. Well, does that mean we can murder and rape and pillage and all these other things? And the answer is no, but not because Moses said not to do it. That would be kind of a tail wagging the dog, all right? And here's what I mean. I gave this illustration, I think last week, somebody called it on a different point, but the same illustration applied. The law against murder in the state of California does not apply to me when I'm in the state of Nevada. If I murder somebody in Nevada, I am tried under Nevada law, not under California law. There are also other things in California law that have no reference in Nevada at all, so they don't even come up. So there might be liabilities or restrictions or liberties or freedoms or rights that come to me in virtue of being in California, but not in Nevada. They're just different contracts, okay? It turns out, though, that there are some things that are similar. And in the same way, we have provisions that are in the Mosaic Law that are temporal and unique to that circumstance, but then we also have provisions that turn out to be universals. Like most of the Ten Commandments, I think nine of them, are actually reflect universal moral obligations. We're not, even though the Ten Commandments were given and the Mosaic Law given to Jews, any people that had a code that include moral conduct are going to have certain things that are going to apply to them, regardless, because they're universals. The obligation not to murder is universal. Now, it shows up in the Ten Commandments, but that's not the only place it shows up. We're not obliged to keep the law in virtue of it being in the Ten Commandments. We're it's in the Ten Commandments in part in virtue, some of these, in virtue of them being universal obligations that no matter where we happen to be in whatever circumstance we're under, we would still be obliged to that universal, like you should murder, okay? So the question that we have to ask ourselves then, now as New Testament Christians in the New Covenant, is with regards to commands that are obligatory for us or moral principles that would apply regardless of the covenants, is to look at the passages in question and ask, does this seem to express a moral obligation that transcends the Mosaic Law? One way to know that is to see how it's worded. Another way to know that is to see if the same kind of directives come up in the New Testament where the Mosaic Law is not operating. And it turns out that virtually every one of the Ten Commandments, save the Sabbath, are also expressed in some way or another in the New Testament as morally obligatory, and other things as well, like homosexuality is forbidden in the Old Testament because a man is lying with a man as he lies with a woman. That is, there's a particular way that human sexuality is supposed to be expressed, and that ain't it. And in the New Testament, we have the commands against homosexuality in 1 Corinthians and Romans 1 and other places, so it becomes really clear that this is a universal, and it is not just simply a provision of the Old Testament law. Now, this allows us to escape a lot of challenges that people might make to us. They say, it looks like you're picking and choosing from the Old Testament law because you're against homosexuality, but you don't follow these other details. And the answer is, well, we are picking and choosing, but we're not doing it arbitrarily. We are looking at, we understand the Old Testament law was given as a contract to Moses, and it was there for very unique and particular purposes for the nation of Israel. But that now has, Gentiles are not under that, and Jews are no longer under that. However, there are some things stated in there that go beyond the law. They're above that, the temporal role of the Mosaic law, and they seem to be universals, and so therefore they're in the New Testament. So we are not being arbitrary when we say homosexuality is forbidden, and look what God says about it in Leviticus, because there it's being expressed, it seems clearly, as a universal, right next to bestiality and child sacrifice, you know. It doesn't seem like these things are right in any culture. And indeed, at the end of the chapter, it says that the people in other cultures practice these things, and they were judged for them. So that's another hint that these are universals and not just, you know, peculiar practices of the Jews. Note also, by the way, in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul talks about the role of the law, that it was a dividing wall that kept the Gentiles and the Jews apart, separated. And he said that dividing wall has been divided, has been torn down now, so that the Jews and the Gentiles can be combined into one new man under the new covenant, having been built on the foundation of the prophets and the apostles and Christ Jesus, the cornerstone. But now the Gentiles are part of that new enterprise called the new covenant. So I've got to take a deep breath here because I've been blabbing for a while. But Chris, does that give you a structure now to see how this kind of all plays together?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, there's still it's still kind of tough to unpack some of the New Testament stuff. Maybe I can call back again sometime to talk about it some more.
I've never had a good answer.
Working through them, you know, the whole, you know, praying with your head covered or uncovered thing. It's a small thing, and I'm trying not to take it in isolation, trying to read the whole, you know, the whole book, the whole chapter, kind of get the context of it, and it's certainly a tough one. It's certainly not something to fall on your sword over either.
It's
one of those interesting examples.
Yeah, I think the broad principle there is a matter of subjection, and that women have a have a symbol of authority that they wore as part of the cultural practice there, and it was important that they do that in that culture because it identified that they were under authority. And so to me, the takeaway is that women are under authority of their husbands, and that when we have egalitarian enterprises that just that simply says that everybody's equal, then and don't not equal in value, but equal in role and responsibility, then this is a diversion from what God has intended, and it creates its own difficulties, it seems to me. So in the church, I just went over this recently, the directives where God in the New Testament talks about the role of the husband and wife, whether it's Ephesians 5 or 1 Peter chapter 3 or there's a 1 Corinthians 10, there's a number of passages. They all say the same thing, and they say it really, really clearly. And that is that the husband is the head of the wife. I mean, to put it simply, and that there should be a responsive relationship. The wife responds to the authority that she's under respectfully. And if you want to use the word submit, you can use the S word, but it's not like submit. You know, that's not the mentality. That's not the idea. But I mean, that is not the connotation there, but it certainly is the meaning of the word that there is a authority. And I think this is being played out in that passage there where Paul is saying that women need to have a symbol of that authority in the context of that cultural group. And there were some things about long hair and short hair, and there were some details about prostitutes having appear one way, and Paul didn't want the women to look like prostitutes in the way they wore their hair and stuff like that. So I think all of those are things that enter in. But I can't give you a much more thoroughgoing answer on the particulars of that passage than I've just offered.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so but glad to help out, and I think the way of looking at these covenants, understanding the role of the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant and the New Covenant, there's an interconnected relationship there, and I think we need to understand it properly in order to properly assess the New Testament teaching that relates to it.
Sure.
All right, Chris?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. Incidentally, it's a good opportunity to make a commercial for a product that I don't plug that much, though I should. It's called the Bible Fast Forward. And in 8 one-hour sessions, I start in Genesis and then I go to the Gospels to show this relationship that I was just talking to my last caller about, Chris. And that is that the backbone covenant of the Bible is the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. And everything that follows flows from the promise God made to Abraham. And the Mosaic covenant and the New Covenant are linked together in interesting ways. And if we don't get these things right, we will read Galatians wrong. We will read Romans wrong. We'll read a lot of things wrong. And I want to highly recommend this group training video series. It has a workbook that I think is about 150 pages long. So it's there in PDF. You can print it out, and everybody in your group gets a copy. But it's all of my notes. So you're not going to go astray taking notes like crazy. It's all right there. You can listen to the teaching. You can discuss it as a group, and all the notes are there. It's a syllabus with all the information. And the feedback I've gotten from so many different people who have run through that course has been really, really fabulous feedback. So it was a game changer for me to understand that information. I think it'll be a game changer for you when you go through that material and understand what's going on there. So I highly recommend to you the Bible Fast Forward. You can get it in DVD for groups, or you can get it in CD form. You want to listen in your car, wherever, on your long commutes in Los Angeles or wherever you happen to be. So a quick recommendation there. Let's go to break, and I'll be back. I got Sergio in Ontario. Serge, don't go anywhere. Can't have people hanging up on me like this, and we'll chat a little bit. Stay with us.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. STR.org is the website, and I have said many times, virtually every time that I speak to an audience, that my desire is to mentor you as an ambassador for Christ, and I think this radio show is a great way to do that. Now, of course, it's one-way communication. In a way, actually a couple of ways, it makes my job easier because I just do my thing here and go home, and not like pastors, you have to be engaged in relationships all the time. But the liability, of course, is there's not a two-way thing in discipleship, but the advantage is I can disciple tens of thousands of people, mentor them in a certain fashion and to a certain degree, and I'm really happy to do that. I mean, I'm thrilled when people tell me that this is that I, through Stand to Reason, has had that impact. But our website is a huge part of that, though, and it's not just me. When the app received this award recently, or we were the top five, it made reference to our team and our deep bench of players and our blogs and our written material and all of the things that the video blogs, the written blogs, the products that we have. So I want to really highly recommend that you make str.org a regular visit. We are consistently putting new things up. It's very easy to navigate. Where do I start is a part of the website there. And if you're a newbie, we'll get you going. All right. Lots of good stuff there. And Amy Hall is in the next room. Melinda's across from me, and they're pounding away on their machines, posting things as I'm talking that relate to the show on Twitter, and they'll go up on the blog tomorrow, and so that you can have access to the things that I've mentioned here. It's a full-service website. It's worth reading the blog every morning. Excellent writers between Amy and Melinda and other staffers. I highly recommend it to you as part of your standard diet of being a disciple of Christ, a Stand to Reason ambassador, and a mentee of yours truly, even at a distance. With that said, let's go to Sergio. And Ontario, is that Ontario, Canada, or Ontario, California, Serge?
Ontario, Canada.
Oh, okay. Glad you called.
I've been calling you like two or three, like every 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, I'm sorry that I didn't recall that. I'm, you know, my mind empties out after every show and after every speaking event. You know, I go somewhere, and then 2 days later, I don't remember where I was. So my apologies. It's just a professional liability.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much for all your work.
Yeah, you're welcome, Serge.
Okay, so my question has to do with I've been teaching a class about the fall of man. Mm-hmm. So, like, questions about Lucifer started coming to my mind. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to put, like, the pieces of the puzzle together.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of, like, get confused when I think about Satan, when we talk about the serpent. And it seems to me like it just comes to my mind, did God create the earth? And then he put Satan here. So, did Satan exist long before us? Mm-hmm. Can we really know things about Satan? or are we going to have to wait for the afterlife?
Yeah, I think that there are some things you can know about him, but I don't know if all the questions you just asked are questions that have answers to them. The Bible, as Francis Schaeffer used to say, is true truth, that is, whatever it affirms, it speaks accurately regarding, but it is not exhaustive truth. It doesn't tell us everything. So there are all kinds of questions people have about Genesis, the early chapters of Genesis, and why didn't God tell us this, that, or the other thing? And I know that some scientists have, I was just listening to a report on, have faulted the New Testament or the book of Genesis because there's not more scientific material and stuff. Well, the book has an intended purpose, and that is to communicate the things that are important for the extension of the kingdom of God, of us being restored and reconciled to God and participating in his purposes until the end of the age. And it speaks of those things. So when Satan is brought up, we don't get a complete taxonomy of kind of Satan information and when he was born and, you know, blah, blah, blah. We just get actually a limited amount of that information about him. And the only thing that we really are told are the things that are most important for God's purposes in the scripture. So, yes, there is a powerful personal force. When I say personal force, I mean he's not a force. He's a person who is forceful, named Satan, and he's not a guy with red tights and a pitchfork. He's a significant player, and he does things, and he accuses, and he tempts, and he blinds. There are actually three different places in the New Testament where it says that Satan blinds the eyes of the unbelievers, that the world is held captive by him to do his will, and one other statement like along the same line. So we know that he really makes a huge difference. We know he's a spiritual entity. We have reason to believe that he fell from heaven as part of the angelic host, and with him took a third of the angels, the angelic company, and these are what we call demons now, and they are pit against God's purposes, and they manifest themselves in different ways. So these are all things that we know about.
Is it true that he was in charge of worship to God?
Well,
or is that
this is the speculation. Let's just put it that way. The Bible does not speak, I think, in clear terms about that. There is a chapter in Ezekiel where there is a lament regarding the king of Tyre. And there was a king of Tyre, an earthly king of Tyre, but the lament seems to go beyond it. And sometimes the prophetic tradition is to communicate two different things at once. You start out talking about one thing, but then you realize that you're telling a different story on a much higher level. And this many have taken to be a lament regarding the fall of Satan, because there seems to be some details about the king of Tyre, or the one called the king of Tyre, which go beyond mere human characteristics. So people have concluded that this is talking about the fall of Satan, who at that point was called Hillel, or Shining One, or we call him Lucifer, and fell from that position of glory because of pride to be a demon and the head of the demons and a significant foe that was partly responsible or played a role in the fall of man in the garden. And though we hear about the serpent there in Genesis chapter 3 in the book of Revelation, the serpent is identified as the devil, as Satan. So we have different information. For me personally, Sergio, I'm not going to make a big deal about the Tyre and the king of Tyre and this whole thing. That does talk about Satan, maybe not. But there's enough information in the scripture, I think, that tell us clearly about our adversary to allow us to be alert for his Wiles. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. But resist him firm in your faith. And then it talks about the suffering of Christians in the world. That's in 1 Peter 5. And so there seems to be a connection between Satan's plans and his machinations and the suffering of Christians around the world. That's something we need to be alert to. So to me, I'm going to focus in on the practical aspects of Christian living that relate to the doctrine of Satan, and not so much on the origin of Satan, because that information is not entirely clear to me.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, what I care about, and there's, you're talking about the fall of man, and I think it's fair to say that Satan played a role in the temptation to entice man to rebel against God. So that we have, you have something substantive and concrete to say regarding Satan on that topic.
And what is your personal view? Do you think, do you believe that the serpent was actually Satan, or was Satan using the serpent to make us fall?
Well, Satan is a spiritual being, so he doesn't have a physical body. So he's not a snake. Because if he were, then when the snake died, Satan would die. It looks like what Satan was doing was making use of that physical body to manifest himself. Now, we see this happening with spiritual beings, or even God manifested himself in physical ways.
When we refer to, like, when I speak about me, I'm not speaking my body, but like I just think of myself as a spiritual being.
Right.
Well,
we have an immaterial self, and so our language might be making reference to our immaterial self. And sometimes, if I say I'm sick, that's me, man. I'm a sick guy today. Well, I'm referring to my body at that point. So we understand that we possess our bodies, and that's integrated into who we are. So we might be referring to either one. That is not the case with the serpent, and because that is not, Satan is not an embodied soul. And the body he has is a snakish body. That's not Satan is a spirit being, and he may adopt a form or take control of an existing body for a purpose. He could even speak through a snake. God spoke through a donkey in the book of Numbers, and God manifested himself in a burning bush. He appeared as a man to Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre. And so there are spirit beings have the possibility of manifesting themselves in different ways, even though they are not essentially physical. And so my sense is that's what happened in the garden. Satan's still around, even though that snake body is long gone, but he seemed to have used that body at the time to tempt Adam and Eve.
And do you know, not talking about like when it's mentioned in Revelations about like the snake, like I have heard some people that they make some connection with the Catholic Church or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I do know something about that. It's an attempt to try to assign values to certain images in the book of Revelation. So you have dragons and you have beasts of many heads and you have different kinds of things going on. And what they're attempting to do is to try to figure out, what do these images betoken? What are they representing? And I don't take any positions on that, because it's just that's hard stuff, and it's easy to go astray and say foolish things that maybe later on you wish you hadn't said. And maybe this is one of those kinds of things. I think there are problems with the Roman Catholic Church, but I don't have any reason to believe that they are prominently featured in the book of Revelation there. Maybe they are. I don't know. But that's not a path I'm going down. Revelation is really a hard book, and it surprises me that so many people are fascinated with it, and they don't understand Romans, but they think they got Revelation figured out. I think we should.
Personally, I try to stay away from that book. I want to get actually the class that I'm teaching. I lead a youth group. We have like 20, 25 mm-hmm. young people, mm-hmm. and so we're going through the basic stuff. But like right. as you teach, like there's so many questions that start coming to your mind. So,
sure.
Like I'm a very curious person, and that's why.
Good for you.
Yeah,
I think it's great, and there's nothing wrong with asking the questions. A lot of questions can't be answered, and probably the ones that can't be answered aren't the ones that are most important anyway, even though we may be really curious about them. I have a hard time reading Jesus because it's hard to get through a chapter without stumbling over something that Jesus says, and I'm just completely mystified as to what he was talking about. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Not everything that he says, but he makes these kinds of statements. And I'm reading through Luke now, and I think, why did he say that? You know, that was really odd. You know, what's going on with that? Some things are very, very clear, and they're very straightforward, here's a statement. No one can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. That's verse 33 of chapter 14 of Luke. Now, I don't know any other place where he makes this demand, and it's clear that not everyone who is his disciple has he demanded giving up everything. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man. Jesus went in his tomb. If Joseph had given up all his possessions, he would have given up his tomb. There had been no rich man's tomb for Jesus to lay in. And earlier in Luke, he says, so is every man who is rich in wealth, but not rich towards God. He talks about the man who's put up all of his stuff in barns, and then that night his soul is required of him. Well, you know, so is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God, Jesus says. So there it's not just being poor all the time, but you know, not rich, but rich towards God at the same time. Anyway, Sergio, it's good talking to you. I thank you for your call. I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Thank you again. Thank you very much, because I know I could count on you when I have my serious questions.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You can do that. Look forward to our next conversation. That's it for us, friends. For all of you with your curious questions, glad to entertain them, do my best on them. Don't forget Nabil Qureshi's book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. I hope you get it. He was our first interview, and if you missed that, you can get it on our website and the podcast. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason, friends. Give him heaven this week, okay? Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.